Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Five, four, three.
She's pure alligator, pure white.
Two.
Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
One!
Albino affairs!
Mano akoye, iye nadu mana mobiliti kiye.
The impressive voice of Salif Keita, the singer from Mali and West Africa, announced his retirement recently. His music will endure, though, as will his advocacy on behalf of people with albinism. Salif is one of them, and he's widely recognized for opening up the discussion in Africa and around the world. Salif Keita's got allies elsewhere in Africa, too, who've joined this fight in their own way, people like Tando Hopa. She's a lawyer and activist from South Africa and now a model, the first person with albinism ever to appear on a Vogue cover, specifically this month's Vogue Portugal edition, dedicated to the diversity of African beauty. Tando Hopa joins us now. Hi, Tando.
Hi, Marco.
My first question actually is not from me, but from a social worker and black woman with albinism from Chicago. Her name is Brandy Marie, and she was really stoked to see you on the cover of Vogue Portugal, and she has a question for you. I'll let her start.
I got really emotional because I just haven't seen myself. Like, growing up, I didn't see myself. I looked through these magazines wanting to see myself represented, and I never did. And I am wondering about how it felt to be in the beauty space and to be called beautiful after growing up and hearing that you were not beautiful or teased, and then sort of how you process that.
Tando Hopa, how do you answer that?
I think, you know, when I grew up, I grew up having parents who were absolutely wonderful, who told me that I was beautiful all the time. But then, you know, when I went into society and I looked at the media space, I wasn't represented with respect to what was portrayed as beautiful. So I started developing inadequacy as I really had a relationship with society. It took quite a while for me to understand beauty in terms of me just being me, in terms of me accepting that my eyebrows are pale, my eyelashes are pale, that my hair is curly and blonde as opposed to curly and black, you know. Mm. I had to go into the modeling industry understanding that my purpose was to focus on representation and saying that the way I look is enough, whether I am on a Vogue cover or not. To be quite honest, when I saw that, when I saw myself on a Vogue cover, I felt more relief than happiness, to be honest.
Relief how?
In that I had gone through so many battles. And a lot of the times when you're going through all of these nuanced battles with respect to representation, when you actually kind of get there, more than anything, you just feel relief that, you know what, I've managed to do this representation to the best of my ability, my way.
I know you've probably told this story many times by now, but maybe one more time, if you could share it with us. How did you go from lawyer and activist to being a model?
I was a prosecutor, and I used to prosecute in sexual offense cases. And what happened is I decided to take a sabbatical, but I had already started my modeling career at the time. I went into it as a platform of representation.
So modeling was activism for you, is activism. How did the industry, the modeling industry, respond to a woman with albinism who is also an activist for albinism?
I started experiencing a great deal of boxing and stereotyping. It was a constant narrative of, you know, prejudice in Africa. And it wasn't that the narrative was not significant or important, it's that it became an all-consuming narrative, and it started almost chipping away at my complete humanity, in that I had experiences that people just did not consider important anymore. I was only the story.
Did you ever think about maybe modeling isn't the way to do this kind of activism?
You know, to be quite honest with you, I think it was one of the best ways, because media was a negotiating medium. It helped negotiate a new narrative with respect to anything, really, and albinism was one of them. So I started learning how to kind of harness a more complete identity with respect to how people see albinism using media through the modeling space.
And then how did this Vogue cover come about?
I received an email from Portugal. They said that it's a cover opportunity. And I thought to myself, cover? I didn't believe it, to be honest with you. And then I went to my mother and I said to him, like, I received an email and it said that it wants to do this particular thing. And they wanted to talk about my work as a diversity advocate. And she said, oh my gosh, do you know there's this human trafficking stuff that's going on? What if these people want to take you to Cape Town and, you know, they're trying to traffic you?
Wow.
And I said to her, and you know, like literally that's how far-fetched the thought was. And we kind of had to do a lot of due diligence to believe it.
Mm. Where was it shot?
It was shot in Cape Town. Mm. I actually brought some of my family jewelry that was very Southern African, because it was, representation is very multifaceted. Yes, there is the woman with albinism, but there's the Southern African Xhosa Sotho woman. And I kind of wanted to do my best to bring sort of everybody with me the best way I could.
Speaking of identity, Tando, I've really been wanting to ask you this question since I learned about your story. Mm-hmm. South Africa, known for apartheid, a government policy that separated whites from blacks for years in society. What did that do mm-hmm. to your own understanding of who you are?
Oh, that's a very intense question. The interesting thing I've learned is race is an institution that really was bred from a figment of somebody's imagination, but had very real consequences, consequences that lived beyond color. Because I am a black woman that still experiences the consequences of what race is, and I don't have the color. But I learned something being in this body. The issue isn't racism, isn't patriarchy, isn't issues with respect to albinism. The issue is that we have a behavioral defect with how we deal with difference.
When do you think, Tando, it won't be a big deal anymore for a person with albinism to be on a cover of Vogue or any fashion magazine, when it's just a model on the cover and she just happens to have albinism?
It's a very difficult question to answer, because I think right now we're getting to a point where people are celebrating firsts quite a lot. You know, you're the first woman to do this. You're the first black person to do that. You're the first person with albinism to do that. You're the first otherly abled person to do this. Firsts are usually kind of a point of progress. The more you kind of get frequency of representation, the more you'll be able to normalize something that is considered extraordinary. Probably frequency would help a lot, because the frequency would kind of not make it a deviance. It would make it a normalization. We kind of need to start setting values that allow for that kind of progress and diversity and inclusion.
Well, Tando Hopa, the photographs with this first in Vogue are gorgeous, and in no small part because of your presence. So keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Irish brother used to sing this when he came in from the tobacco fields. Mmm, mama, His master gonna sell us tomorrow. Yes, yes, yes. Mama, his master gonna sell us tomorrow. Yes, yes, yes.
Many African Americans who descended from people brought to the U.S. during the transatlantic slave trade don't know where their ancestors are from. And more of them in recent years are using DNA tests like Ancestry and 23andMe to find answers. As St. Louis Public Radio's Eli Chen reports, the tests can be useful in confirming speculations African Americans have about their ethnicity, but the results can be rather limited.
St. Louis native Aaliyah Holman says her ethnic identity has always been a mystery.
My mother's family did not really know much. They're from Arkansas, so they know their American history as being descendants of slaves and sharecroppers.
Her father's parents came from Jamaica, but Holman says,
I think we all still understand that there's some part of the diaspora involved where the Jamaicans were brought over from one of the countries in continental Africa.
To find out where her ancestors came from, she did a lot of what Black Americans have been doing lately, buying DNA test kits for themselves or their relatives. The slave trade during the early founding of the United States erased a lot of knowledge about family histories and countries of origin. Crystal Williams from East St. Louis used kits from Ancestry, Family Tree DNA, and 23andMe.
There's no value you can put on a DNA test when you're researching your family history as an African American. You know, they tell you you can only get so far, but that's not true. Along with DNA and the other documents that are now coming to light, you can go past slavery.
Professional genealogist Kathleen Brandt in Kansas City says DNA tests are a good tool for her African American clients who want to know more about their ancestry. Taking a test is one of the first things she recommends they do, but the results provide just a small part of the picture.
It is not the answer, but it puts us in the right direction of where we need to be researching.
As more people submit their DNA to Ancestry's database, the results can change. Brandt says it's important not to get too invested.
There's nothing worse than people getting attached because it's hard to explain to them, I'm so sorry you're not 100% Irish or Scottish or Cameroon. You know, it is a very difficult process because a lot of stake in our identity.
Aaliyah Holman says her father's initial results from Ancestry showed that he was 40% Nigerian. A year later, his account showed that the Nigerian percentage dropped to 3 and that there was a much higher percentage for Cameroon and the Congo.
So that was a little frustrating and disappointing. I had put a certain amount of stock in the idea of Nigerianness and even had conversations with friends of mine who are Nigerian, and I'd say, look at me, do I look more Igbo or more Yoruba? And they would try to make some decisions about that.
Yasmira Emefor, another St. Louis resident, says she took a test because people from Nigeria would approach her and insist she was Nigerian.
Nigerians would say it's how you carry yourself, it's because you're thin.
Like Holman, she had no idea where her ancestors came from. She took a test from Connect My DNA, and it said her roots could be traced back to Nigeria, the Bahamas, and France. Many African Americans have seen European ancestry turn up in their results. Eric Depperdine in Kansas City says he got his grandmother's DNA tested and found out that he's related to a couple of Quaker men. Given the brutal history of the slave trade, he wasn't surprised to find those white or European roots.
Part of us, whether we like it or not, it's painful, and it sucks having to talk about how our grandmothers were treated a long time ago. But unfortunately, we can't do anything about that in 2019, but just recognize that that's part of us and don't let those stories fade into oblivion.
Depperdine, like the others, was also motivated to use DNA tests so he could tell stories about his ancestors the way that his parents and grandparents did. With genetic technology, African Americans can make those stories more complete, and they can see more clearly where they fit in the very complicated history of African Americans in the U.S. I'm Eli Chen, St. Louis Public Radio.
You don't know.
Is the one with the little kids?
The little kids.
Just sitting around, just little, I don't know what he is, like an Indian kid, cute little black kid. Like, I'm Tiger Woods.
I'm Tiger Woods.
You guys are in advertising, right?
Yeah, you too.
But, I hope you don't mind, but I was intrigued by your conversation. Then. I just thought you were in advertising. So I want to give you my dream version of a Tiger Woods commercial, okay?
Go ahead. Needs,
yeah. There's this black guy on a golf course. And all these people are trying to get him to caddy for them, but he's not a caddy. He's just a guy trying to play a round of golf. Then these guys give him a $5 bill and tell him to go to the clubhouse and get him cigarettes and beer. So off he goes. Home. To his wife and to their little son, who he teaches to play golf. We see all the other little boys playing hopscotch while little Tiger practices on the putting green. We see all the other kids eating ice cream while Tiger practices hitting long balls in the rain while his father shows him how. And we fade up to Tiger winning 4 Grand Slams in a row and becoming the greatest golfer to ever pick up a 9-iron. And we end on his father in the crowd on the sidelines, and Tiger giving him the trophies. All because of a father's determination that no fat white man, like your father's probably, would ever send his son to the clubhouse for cigarettes and beer.
I'm sorry, what did you say about our fathers?
25 years ago, an 18-year-old named Eldrick Woods won his first amateur golf championship. Yesterday, the man who was so famous he later became known by one name won golf's best-known major championship for the 5th time. In between is a tale that our next guest says competes with Shakespeare. Nick Schifrin has the story of Tiger Woods' comeback.
Youngest golfer ever to win a major, to win all 4 majors, to be ranked number 1. Player of the year more than any other golfer. Leading money winner of all time. At his peak, Tiger Woods was not only considered the greatest golfer in modern history, many considered him the greatest athlete. He changed the face of golf fundamentally, racially, and socially. At the height of his career, golf got more viewers than basketball and football. He was one of the most famous men in the world. And then the crash from grace. Dozens of affairs, the mugshot, and injuries that made him predict he would never play again. But there he was yesterday, winning the Masters, his first major in 11 years. To talk about Tiger's comeback, I'm joined by Armin Katayan, the co-author of Tiger Woods and the executive producer of The Athletic. Armin, thank you so much for being on the NewsHour. Talk about the arc from the height of his stardom to that DUI photo in 2017 to yesterday. You wrote on Twitter today that Shakespeare had nothing on what we're witnessing now.
Well, I don't think so. When you talk about a rise and a fall, an epic fall from grace, and then this story of redemption, you know, the rise back to prominence. But it's more, I think, Nick, because of the depths that Tiger fell to, I think it's a hole that, unlike any other athlete, any celebrity, businessman, you name it, has ever reached. It was rock bottom and then some. And then to rise out of that, not to just to get healthy and to be able to walk again, but to walk, you know, that final fairway at Augusta yesterday, make the putt leading to his 5th green jacket. I mean, it's like a fairy tale. It's almost unimaginable.
Let's talk about rock bottom, as you put it, in 2 respects. The first respect, how bad did it get when it came to his affairs and frankly, his attitude to the game and to his fans and to everyone?
It's safe to say, as you mentioned, there were multiple affairs beginning, you know, well, shortly after he got married. It didn't really slow Tiger down at all. And there it was just that coupled with the kind of person that he became. In many ways, as I mentioned, Tiger was a machine. He was programmed almost like a computer to do one thing, which was to win golf tournaments. And it came with a price. And that was what drove Jeff Benedict and I in the writing of the book was, what is the price of genius? What's the cost of genius? And in Tiger's case, it was a completely entitled person, an individual who showed very little appreciation and gratitude for others who were doing things for him. Even a simple thank you at times was too much for Tiger to offer.
How bad was the pain? How bad did it get in terms of his back?
Well, for a long stretches of time, many, many weeks, and sometimes even months, he could barely get out of bed. I mean, there was one stretch where he barely got out of bed for 10 straight days. You know, every step he took was pain personified. And there were points in time where Tiger never felt, A, he could swing a golf club again, but it was unclear as to how well he would actually be able to walk again.
Golf is not only, of course, about physical ability, it's also mental ability. How do you think he went from that rock bottom to what we saw yesterday?
Well, he went through rehab, and I think he took a long look at himself in the mirror and said, is this the kind of father that I want to be to my two children? He loves his kids. Earl loved him, and
Earl,
Tita loved him, his mom. Yes, Earl the father and Tita the mother loved him, but they loved him in a different way. I think Tiger has taken what he learned from his parents, what he liked and what he didn't like, and has turned a tremendous amount of love to his children. And I think he looked in the mirror and said, really, is this the kind of dad that I want my children to be around and to be raised by? And whatever he went through in rehab, whatever he said to himself or others said to him, it changed him.
Which brings us to the juxtaposition of two moments, I would say. One, we saw this incredible video yesterday of Tiger hugging his son right after he won, saying, I love you, son. And from 1997, of course, one of the most famous moments perhaps in the last few decades in golf history, Tiger being embraced by his father, Earl, who said, I love you, son.
When I saw him hug Charlie, the first thing that came to my mind was like, oh, my God, this is 1997 all over again. That iconic scene with Earl right after he had won the Masters by 12 strokes and just a record-setting performance. That was the arrival of Tiger Woods in the biggest of ways and really truly the beginning of Tiger Mania for good or bad. And then to see Charlie there and to see the way Tiger hugged him, that was a generational hug. That was from father to son to father to son.
Very quickly, the president has said that he will award Tiger Woods the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Does Tiger Woods deserve it?
Well, if it's for an impact on the sport, an influence in a game, I mean, you referenced it socially, culturally, financially, racially. He changed the game of golf, and in many ways, he changed the ways of sport. So if we're talking about a kind of a lifetime achievement award for the influence that he's had, he absolutely deserves it. And he's probably got a lifetime pass now to play with President Trump anytime, any place. So comes with a set of benefits there, too, I imagine.
I would imagine so. Arun Mikatyan, author of the book Tiger Woods, executive producer of The Athletic. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Nick. Thank you.
Black babies cost less.
In child welfare cases, the city's administration for children's services must get a court order to separate a family. But the city can remove a child without a judge's approval in emergencies. It turns out city workers have wielded this power more often and in situations that don't seem to warrant it. WNYC's Yasmin Khan has the story.
About a year and a half ago, Tonya Lovell and her 18-month-old daughter, Eliana, needed housing. They were in the process of applying for shelter in the Bronx, but as Lovell tells it, the city rejected her twice, possibly because she did have a roof over her head at the time, at her brother's in Brooklyn, a large house where he rented out some of the rooms.
I don't pay attention to who's in the house because my main focus is my daughter and me.
One day, Lovell's brother evicted a couple of the tenants for not paying rent. He found marijuana plants and ammunition and called the police.
The cops came. They was there overnight.
It was a messy situation, literally. The cops turned some of the rooms upside down in their search. It took a while. An hour or so after they left, Friday evening, a child protective worker came knocking.
She came in.
Took a look around.
She asked me, oh, don't you see anything wrong with this place you're living in?
ACS does not comment on specific cases, but according to a petition later filed in family court, the worker observed things like trash all around the house, a practically empty kitchen with no food, and the smell of marijuana. The petition charged Lovell with child neglect.
At least I have a roof over my childhood, and we're not outside in the street in the cold. It's a temporary house, it's not a permanent.
The confrontation with the child protective worker that night was tense. The woman consulted with her supervisor, and together they decided the baby, Eliana, could not remain in the house or in her mother's care. Not for one more moment. So the child protective worker scooped the toddler into her arms and under the care of city government.
I said to my child, I said, I'm sorry. Please forgive Mama, but I'm going to get you.
As Lovell tells it, she was crying. Eliana looked confused.
It felt like you're just going to have a baby and somebody just rip your child out your womb.
These so-called emergency removals, when the city separates a parent and child without going to court first, should only happen when a child's life or health is in imminent danger. That's spelled out in state law. And it should be the exception, says Jessica Marcus, a supervising attorney at Brooklyn Defender Services. It's the practice that would later represent Lovell in court.
The right to have a judge look at this decision is not just a parent's right. It's the children's right.
She's alarmed by how ACS has flexed these emergency powers, and at a higher rate. 5 years ago, of the nearly 4,000 children separated from their parents, a little more than a third were removed without going to court first. Last year, it was nearly half. Almost all children involved were non-white, about 90%. And Marcus says almost all were poor.
It's a fear that's being instilled in certain communities that somebody could come and remove your child.
The trauma of separating a child from a parent can be lasting. It's something that pediatricians and child psychologists, even city leaders, loudly asserted when migrant families were separated at the border last year. Emma Ketteringham, who leads the family defense practice at the Bronx Defenders, says with the harm of removal at stake, it's crucial to preserve due process.
If you remove a child before you go to court, that means the parent does not have an attorney. That means the child or the children does not have an attorney. It means that essentially there's no team yet working with the parent to address whatever safety risks might exist.
Or to challenge the agency's facts. And communication is not always good in the fraught moment of a child being taken from a parent, as in Lovell's case.
She's going to walk out that door without telling me, where am I getting my daughter? Where my child is going.
The Administration for Children's Services has protocols. During emergency removals, parents are supposed to receive information about where their child will be and who to contact there, plus a notice explaining a parent's rights. Lovell says she didn't receive any of this. Frantic, she called 911 and then 311, trying to figure out where Eliana was. An operator found an office number that Lovell could try on Monday.
I said, ma'am, this lady just took my child. I cannot wait till Monday.
So Lovell Googled ACS and eventually found the Children's Center in Manhattan. It's a holding place for the kids before they're placed in foster care. On Saturday morning, Lovell called and located Eliana there. Emergency removals don't always go down this way, though Lovell's case is not an anomaly. Colleen Montague, a child protective worker not involved in the case, says she does this work because she genuinely wants to help families. She describes her approach this way.
When you're in the home, you're just there to get an understanding of what's happening, right? So being mindful to not step on toes, to not let families feel like you're overstepping boundaries.
I spoke with Montague and another worker named Waleed Gauss in a conference room at the Children's Center, the same building where ACS took Eliana. Gauss and Montague are part of a unit that works nights and weekends, so they have to determine, with their supervisors, whether children can safely stay home or not. Gauss says a removal is a last resort.
Thankfully, most of our cases are not intentional abuse and neglect, but the ones that are, we have to step in because we're the voice for that child.
Of some 60,000 abuse and neglect reports the city investigates each year, most do not result in removals. To be clear, the vast majority of those reports involve neglect, not abuse, and they're neglect issues that, according to advocates, often relate to poverty, like Lovell's situation of inadequate housing. Again, here's public defender Emma Ketteringham.
The child protection system should be for children who are truly at risk of serious harm in the care of their parent. It should not be the city's primary response to family poverty.
Over the course of the weekend that Eliana was separated from her mother, she went from the child protective worker to the staff at the Children's Center to a foster home. At the first court hearing to review the removal, the judge returned Eliana to Lovell's care.
When Eliana came, Eliana looked so different.
In the court order, the judge basically said, yes, Eliana was exposed to squalid living conditions. But he added, Lovell had no choice because she tried to get into shelter. He wrote, quote, the harm of removal is not insubstantial, as the child is 18 months old and has lived her entire life with her mother. ACS still continued its investigation into child neglect. The case was dismissed 8 months later. Eliana and Lovell just moved into their own apartment, and Eliana, who's almost three, plays almost every day with a couple of the upstairs neighbors. Lovell says for about a year after the removal, Eliana didn't want to leave her side.
I mean, Mommy, where you going, Mommy? Please don't leave. Come take off your shoes, Mom.
Lovell says things are better, but the effects of the removal still reverberate. Lovell says she often feels low, maybe has depression. She doesn't want to see anyone about it, though, because she fears being reported to the child welfare system. Yasmin Khan, WNYC News.
Marijuana use has largely been decriminalized in New York City, but it still plays a role in child neglect cases. And as in the criminal justice system, people of color are penalized disproportionately for marijuana use. WNYC's Yasmin Khan tells the story of a Bronx mother who was separated from her newborn following a positive marijuana test after delivery. It's part two of our series on the city's increased use of emergency powers to remove children from their parents.
The case for removing Cynthia's newborn baby started at the birth with a marijuana test for both mother and daughter. Providers at the public hospital where Cynthia delivered likely wanted to test them because months before, Cynthia told her doctor she had smoked pot early in her pregnancy. After delivery, a social worker came back with the test results.
And she was like, oh, your urine came back positive for marijuana. I was like, how? Like, I stopped smoking so long ago.
But her baby, Maya, had a negative urine test. So the hospital released mother and daughter. They went back to the family shelter in the Bronx, where they lived with Maya's dad. As Cynthia talks, Maya snuggles into her chest, ready for a nap.
Here you go, stinky butt.
By the way, Cynthia and Maya are not their real names. We agreed to change them since Cynthia's case in family court is still pending, and she's closely under the supervision of the Administration for Children's Services. 2 weeks after the birth, they visited the pediatrician for a routine checkup at the hospital clinic. Cynthia says the baby was doing great, but that's when the doctor had results from a second drug test Maya was given after birth. It was positive for marijuana. The pediatrician said he needed to report it.
So he said, basically, we're going to have to call ACS and inform them.
Health providers are mandated reporters of child abuse and maltreatment and can use their discretion. But the city's Health and Hospitals Corporation has a policy. A newborn's positive drug test alone should not warrant a report of child neglect unless there's a sign drug use is impairing a mother's ability to care for her child. The pediatrician declined to speak about Cynthia's case, citing federal privacy laws. But she says he tried to allay her fears about reporting her to the government.
And he said, well, it shouldn't really be a big deal. This kind of thing happens all the time. Somebody may not even come. They may just call you on the phone, or they may just come and just check and see if everything's okay.
But it was a big deal. A day later, Friday night, a child protective worker came to the Bronx shelter where Cynthia and her family were staying.
She was like, well, yeah, so I'm just going to let you know. We're probably going to have to remove the baby.
It's important to know that Cynthia had a prior case of child neglect with two older children from years ago. It was based on alcohol use. Cynthia thinks this is why ACS was quick to open a new case now. Still, she thought a removal was extreme, let alone one imposed with emergency powers. Because, as with the hospital policy, to remove a child solely based on a positive drug test would violate ACS's own rules.
That is what ACS's policy is, yes, but that is not how it happens in practice.
This is Emma Ketteringham, managing director of the Family Defense Practice at the Bronx Defenders. It's the attorney group representing Cynthia. Ketteringham says to remove a child without going to court first, the child must be in imminent danger. That's the legal threshold.
But what we have seen in the last couple years is an increase in the exercise of the emergency removal power in cases where it is later determined not to be warranted.
Since ACS doesn't talk about specific cases, it's hard to know why the agency ordered a removal for Cynthia. But Ducoste Lamoth, an assistant commissioner at the agency, talked me through the general thinking behind an emergency removal.
They're done with the information we had at that point. That was clear that children were in imminent danger. It doesn't mean a day later or 3 days later that circumstances have not changed.
Meaning a parent may later show willingness to make a change at home or share more information. Usually this happens in court when a parent also has legal representation for the first time. Lamoth oversees an emergency services unit that operates nights and weekends when court is closed. So his team is often making that calculation of whether to remove a child through emergency powers or not.
We're not prepared to conduct any removal unless we have a sense and we're very clear that the child cannot remain in that home.
To be clear, the child welfare system pretty much only investigates poor, non-white families. And in the case of emergency removals, nearly half of the children are Black. The disparities are an ongoing national problem, says researcher Jessica Price, who leads the Florida Institute for Child Welfare.
There are implicitly higher standards for parenting if you're a Black mom, or if you're a Hispanic mom, or if you're a Native American mom.
And she says the system is built to punish them when those standards aren't met. Price recalls her own experience as a child protective worker in Florida before she entered academic life.
I used to tell people, I do this work because, you know, kids deserve someone to protect them.
But she says there's actually a problem with that thinking.
I mean, their parents can protect them if we give them the tools. And what every child really wants is for their parents to be okay.
Helping families and keeping kids at home is ACS's goal, too. And the city has made great strides in bringing down the number of children in foster care over the last two decades. But all of the parents I've interviewed who've come in contact with the agency describe a system still mired in punitive thinking. Mothers say they feel scrutinized by agency workers who seem to only search for the negative, all while holding the power to remove children, like in Cynthia's case.
I was, like, really scared. I was amazed that they can even do that.
The night that a child protective worker came to Cynthia's door, prompted by the pediatrician's report of a positive drug test, the city conducted an emergency removal by forcing Cynthia to leave. She was told to quickly pack a bag and go. Two-week-old Maya would remain at the shelter where they were staying with her dad.
This is his first child. So I was basically trying to explain, like,
She spent most of the time trying to pre-fill bottles and explain feedings to Maya's dad, who works and hadn't been alone with the baby that much. Cynthia didn't have a place to go right away, so she rode the subway all night. She's rattled thinking back on it.
Then every time I would call him, like, you hear the baby screaming and screaming. And, like, he doesn't really know what to do. So it was just, like, horrible.
At the court hearing 2 days later, the judge rejected ACS's removal order, and Cynthia went home to Maya. The investigation is ongoing. Cynthia gets visits from ACS and a caseworker from an outside organization. She does on-the-spot drug testing. They've also asked her to undergo alcohol testing and a mental health evaluation.
Instead of trying to help the parents, they always try to, like, police them and nitpick with them. And it's like they want to play God.
She says it's like you have to constantly prove that you deserve your kids. Her case goes to trial in family court this spring. Yasmin Khan, WNYC News.
Because the white man's got a God complex. I'm making guns.
I'm God.
I'm God. I'm making bombs.
I'm God.
I'm God. I'm making gas.
I'm God.
I'm making freak machines.
I'm God.
Birth control pills.
I'm God.
Kill Indians who discovered him.
I'm God.
Kill Japanese with the A-bomb.
I'm God.
Kill and still killing black people.
I'm God.
Enslaving Earth.
I'm God.
No way to the moon.
I'm God.
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 Spell backwards is dog.
Federal investigators are in Northeast Montana this week looking into alleged racial discrimination in public schools. Three investigators from the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights Seattle region spent Monday speaking with Wolf Point School District administrators and families. Their visit stems from a federal complaint filed by the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes in June of 2017. The complaint alleged widespread discrimination against Native American students. Examples include school administrators segregating students based on race instead of academic ability, Native students being bullied for long traditional hair, and kicking Native girls off the high school basketball team because they had babies, while white players were allowed to stay on. School staff are quoted saying negative stereotypes and racial slurs, like when a coach reportedly said, quote, "dirty Indians," end quote, during basketball practice. Lillian Alvernez is an Indigenous Justice Legal Fellow at the ACLU of Montana, which filed the complaint on behalf of the tribes with the U.S. Departments of Education and Justice. Alvernez, who's Dakota and Nakota, says the Office for Civil Rights' investigation is narrowly focused on potential violations of the Federal Civil Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Although
the issues we heard about and the stories we heard about are much larger than that narrow focus. There are systemic issues, institutional issues with the public education system, with the Indian education relationship.
Alvarez says the Office for Civil Rights Investigators will spend Tuesday and Wednesday interviewing more families, teachers, and coaches, and collecting documentation of the alleged discrimination. She says the complaint traces the school district's current culture back to federal policies and boarding schools that preferenced white homesteaders over tribal members in the early 1900s.
Non-Indian education was brought to Indian people and tribes as a form of assimilation and genocide. And it was only recently, within the last 50 years or so, that education started to be used as a tool to help Indian people.
The ACLU, Office for Civil Rights, and Fort Peck Youth Advocates are hosting a series of community meetings this week. Luella Contreras says she hopes the meetings impress upon teachers and educators the true meaning of a saying she hears often, "The youth is our future."
To me, when they say that, do they really know what they're saying? Because if they do, they would realize that education should not be a struggle for our youth. It should be a chance for our Native children to realize a dream for themselves, a place, a school system that cares about their dreams.
Contreras says her granddaughter filed complaints detailing bullying, but school administrators did little in response.
They never did talk to her. You know, it's like they're ignoring her.
She says a Native American teacher singled out her grandson. She thinks it was racially based and adds it's complicated. She says other parents tell her that their children have not experienced mistreatment.
And I say that's fine. If your kids made it through there without having any trouble, then that's good. You should count yourself to be lucky. But there are kids, many kids, that have had trouble.
She says she hopes the investigation will make a difference in how the administration reacts to complaints like hers.
You can't change a person's racism, but if the school starts making people accountable when there is a racist problem or when something does come up that looks like it's racist, if they deal with it, make those people accountable, then maybe that would stop it.
The Office for Civil Rights Investigation could result in a set of specific actions the school district must take, along with a timeline to address the alleged violations. The office's final report is expected in the fall or summer this year. An attorney for Wolf Point School District and a representative from the U.S. Department of Education did not respond to an interview request by deadline. Kayla DeRoche contributed reporting to this story. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
Prominent blacks and whites giving orders for mass slaughters. I want all my daughters to be like Maxine Waters.
President Donald Trump has pushed freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar back in the headlines, this time for comments in a speech she gave at the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, last month. The president tweeted her comments out of context alongside images of the 9/11 attack, fanning the flames of growing anger towards Omar, especially from conservatives. He continued his attack last night at a KSTP interview in Minnesota.
She's been very disrespectful, frankly, to Israel. She is somebody that doesn't really understand, I think, life, real life. It's unfortunate. She's got a way about her that's very, very bad, I think, for our country. I think she's extremely unpatriotic and extremely disrespectful to our country.
Omar, along with Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, is one of the first two Muslim women to be elected to Congress ever. They are also some of the few women of color to have served in Congress. So those attacks are taking a deeper tone than the regular partisan vitriol that's characterized much of recent U.S. politics. Omar spoke about this dynamic with Stephen Colbert last week and how she doesn't always feel defended even by her own side.
It's the same that I expect. So when you have people on Fox News that question whether I'm actually American or I put America first, I expect my colleagues to also say that's not okay, like that they should, you know, that because I'm a Muslim, I'm an immigrant, I'm a refugee, that I can't have any loyalty to our country. I took an oath.
Omar's office has reported a spike in death threats against the congresswoman since President Trump retweeted the inflammatory video. Congresswoman Tlaib responded in defense.
They do this all the time to us, especially women of color. They do that. They take our words out of context because they're afraid, because we speak truth. We speak truth to power.
But for some observers, this is just another example of women of color in positions of power being attacked and mistreated, used for political gain, sometimes even by their peers and those along the same ideological lines. Donna Edwards is with us. She represented Maryland for 10 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, and she's a contributing columnist to The Washington Post. And Andrea Benjamin is a political science professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Thank you both for your time. Donna, let's start with you. Congresswoman Edwards, you were the first Black woman to represent Maryland in Congress. Did you meet any resistance to your presence once you arrived in D.C.?
Well, I think all the time, and sometimes in really big ways and others in small ways. I think, you know, my experience in the Congress was particularly speaking out on issues of foreign policy, most specifically around Israel and Palestine, that I came under attack all the time. And that was not new. I mean, I think if you look at the history of a number of women of color, Black women in the Congress, that was true for many of them as well. And so, you know, I think when, especially on foreign policy, when you're quote, not in your box. You know, it's okay to talk about, you know, food stamps and criminal justice and issues that, quote unquote, are, you know, sort of in the wheelhouse of people of color, then that's fine. But then you start talking about foreign policy or larger domestic policy and you're not in your box. And I think there are people both within the party and outside who make sure that you know that.
Congresswoman, I want to follow up on that because I think a lot, there are many professional women of color in particular who would agree. Going back to what the president said earlier in the segment about Representative Omar, he used terms like disrespectful, unpatriotic, and essentially saying she, quote unquote, doesn't understand life. That goes beyond policy.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it's very personal. And, you know, to say that someone who came to the United States as a refugee who suffered under, you know, difficult conditions and has made and built a life here and then run for Congress to represent her district, to say, one, that she's unpatriotic, but, you know, two, that she doesn't understand life. I think, you know, if anything, the president doesn't understand life and the lives that we lead. And I think he used the phrase our country as though somehow it's not her country, too. And I think that this characterization of women of color, of anyone who's sort of outside the norm as them and us is something that the president does quite intentionally. And for women of color, it sticks very brutally. And I do agree with Congresswoman Omar that not many in our party have come to her defense. And we ought to, because frankly, any of us could be on the, you know, chopping block of the president or anyone else. And it's ironic that the discussion, you know, centers around this group of women of color. But you have Representative Steve King from Iowa, and he just kind of skates by. Sure, he's lost his committee positions, but he continues to say inflammatory things. And you never hear the president or others in the leadership really denounce him.
Professor Benjamin, I want to bring you in here because we know, as we've mentioned already, that there have been far and few, not just Muslim women in Congress, but women of color in Congress. And we've just heard Congresswoman Edwards describe some of those challenges. Professor, how is what we're seeing today in terms of tone, context, and tenor different from what we've seen historically? Or is it different from what we've seen historically?
I'm not sure if it's different historically. I think the context is different. Obviously, we were all, well, many of us were really excited to look at this incoming class of Congress people. It's the most diverse it's ever been, and yet it still looks pretty bad. So I think in that sense, you know, these numbers are going up, and so there is this feeling of change, right? And let's be clear, and let's give them the credit that's due them. They ran pretty aggressively. They already didn't follow the rules because I know each one of these freshman women was probably told, it's too soon, it's not your time. And they said, okay. Some of them took out incumbents. Some of them are representing, you know, majority white districts. So they've already sort of challenged the status quo. And so now that they're there, right, they're working from a position of, let me try to keep the promises I made to my constituents. And so I don't expect them to change. What I think is happening is that we're just relying on old school stereotypes, right? So as former Congresswoman Edwards said, right, you know, if this were a man doing these things, they would be described as assertive, not aggressive, entrepreneurial, not being able to follow directions, right? So I think it's just this sort of strange place where stereotypes are easy to tap into, and that's what's being used, right? There's nothing about Congresswoman Omar that shows that she's not patriotic or un-American. She's seen a lot more than many of us, right? And still she answered the call to serve in this capacity. She could have done a lot of other things, but this was the capacity that she chose to serve. It's obviously not easy. Her life is being threatened. I view that as pretty patriotic. And again, I think it's just the intersection of these stereotypes, right, that all Muslims are terrorists, and that's just not true, right? So, but it's easy to use, and that's what's happening here.
And also, Professor, I'd love to broaden this a little bit beyond Congress. I mean, it's no secret that not just our Congress is lacking in diversity, specifically when it comes to women of color, but the rest of our society in positions of leadership is also lacking that. Corporate board seats, for example, some of the highest levels and the highest jobs in this country are also really lacking in diversity. So how much of what we're talking about here applies to most, if not all, women of color in positions of power, Professor?
I think it applies pretty broadly. Obviously, I'm in a particular discipline, political science, and, you know, sometimes when I think about it, there's so few of us, right? And so when I stand in front of the classroom, students say, oh my goodness, you're my first professor that's a person of color, you're my first professor that's a woman. And so I already know that we're not represented. And again, I think there are just challenges, and these stereotypes affect, you know, women of color across all walks of life, right? Again, when we speak clearly, oh, we're aggressive, right? I mean, the stereotypes are just so easy to use that when we, you know, express dissatisfaction, oh, we're angry, right? And so I think that for most women of color that are watching this unfold at this level of the Congress, they probably have their own stories where these stereotypes have been used against them as well. So I think in a broader sense, this is not new to most women of color, especially those of us who strive to be in positions of power, but even just in our day-to-day lives, I think that this is just in general, right? That we've sort of tried to reach beyond our means and we're trying to get out of our particular lane, right?
And I'm wondering if we could even talk about how we get past this. And I think it's unfair to ask women of color to solve the problem that they haven't created, but how do we get past this, whether it's in Congress or not?
Sure. I mean, at the end of the day, it is your constituents who reelect you. So it doesn't really matter what the rest of the country thinks. So if these, you know, young women are serving their constituents, they will be reelected, and eventually seniority will put them into power. So again, this notion that they have to play the right way, I don't know that I agree with that. The other piece is, you know, I study campaigns, and one thing that people can do is they can campaign to win. Sometimes they campaign to put issues on the table, and there'll be no denying whatever happens with this class's reelection, that they put issues on the table. And I think that maybe for some of them, that's good enough. So I don't know that they're thinking about it the same way that we historically have. What do I think needs to change? I mean, you know, I agree it shouldn't be on the backs of women of color, but unfortunately, we have to be willing to serve when asked. And I mean that in a lot of capacities, right? Whether it's elected office or we're willing to be the one face on the board, right? Because when you're the only one, it can be really challenging. But as Congresswoman Edwards said, I mean, sort of you have to sort of be willing to do those things, really to set the tone and let other people know that this is a space for us.
Congresswoman, I want to bring you back in here because I wonder if what we're seeing today, these women are also not backing down. There isn't a sense of, you know, being intimidated by a lot of these attacks. In fact, they seem to be addressing these issues head on. In your experience, is that an effective tool for D.C., for Washington, for Congress?
Well, I think it's complicated. I mean, I was described as an aggressive legislator, and that wasn't in the positive sense. It was used as a negative, and I think it can cut against you. It can cut against you in terms of your relationship with your colleagues. I think these women are experiencing that. But you know what? It's a risk worth taking, because otherwise the alternative is just to stay in your place and be quiet. And I think what these women are saying is that they're not willing to do that, that the importance of their representation means that they are called to serve and called to speak out. And you know, look, I ran for the U.S. Senate and I was attacked for playing quote unquote identity politics. And I used to say to people all the time, my identity is my politics, my experience as a Black woman, my experience as a person in the workplace, my experience as a single mom. These are my identities, and I should be able to use that in my politics. And I think the same is true for these particular women. And, you know, the more that they stand up, the more they pave a way for other women to come and join them, because there is power in numbers. And what you can see here is, you know, the attacks are coming all ways, but they have to single out an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or an Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib. But they represent a space that's really for all of us. And, you know, I just applaud them. And every time I get a chance, whether it's on social media or on television or the radio, I always, you know, make sure that I point to their achievements and to their voices, because I think they need backup. And some of us can be part of that backup.
Donna Edwards is a congresswoman who represented Maryland for 10 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congresswoman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Andrea Benjamin is a political science professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Thanks to you, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
North Carolina.
Last night, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney met with members of the public not to talk at people, but to listen. And the public was ready to question Putney about police training, the use of deadly force, and about the footage from the body camera worn by Officer Wendy Curl. Curl, a white police officer, shot and killed 27-year-old Danquarius Franklin, a black man, in the parking lot of a Burger King about 3 weeks ago. WFAE's Sarah DeLeo was at the church where the event was held and has this report.
Before Chief Kerr Putney walked inside the doors of the AME Zion Church in West Charlotte, which is about a mile away from the Burger King where Danquarius Franklin was fatally shot, Putney met outside with reporters. Since the release of the body camera footage on Monday, many questions have risen. Were de-escalation tactics used? Why was this video released and not others? Putney said he couldn't get into specifics about the case because of an internal investigation. However, when Putney was asked about any other body camera footage besides the one released, this was his response.
There's but one body worn camera video footage. One.
Putney added that if an officer were to not have their camera on, it would be, quote, a pretty serious offense. Putney wrapped up with reporters and headed inside. A prayer started the evening.
But we come, God, to share so that we can find common ground to bless this community, to bless this city government, and to bless the work of our hands as we minister to the people who have been hurt by this event.
The crowd was made of mostly African Americans. There were also some police officials, journalists, and a group of city council members sitting in the front, including Mayor Vi Lyles. Ground rules were set. Putney would listen and respond to questions or statements, if appropriate, and members of the audience would keep their comments civil. And then it got intense. The first question was from Minister Sean Richardson. The question was for both Chief Putney and Mayor Lyles.
Based on everything that's happened since under you guys' watch, why have neither one of you considered stepping down? Because I feel like this city has not been more dangerous than the climate we have right now under you guys' leadership. And I mean that with all due respect. Sure. I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Putney's response.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your opinion. Here's what I'll tell you. Since we're being real, we have too much work to do for me to quit. I'm not going to quit. I'm sick of seeing this, too.
Questions came from the audience about what type of training officers receive and if that training involves de-escalation. Many pointed out it was hard to see how de-escalation was used in the moments leading up to the shooting death of Danquarius Franklin. Others had a different perspective. One woman in the audience urged everyone to put themselves in the shoes of the officer. She pointed out Officer Curl asked Franklin more than once to put down the gun.
I'm just making my statement. And I'm just making my statement. It's just the bottom line. How many times does an officer have to try to communicate, try to get you to comply?
Ray Coffey, who was standing near her, was clearly upset by her comments. Chief Putney asked him to speak. Coffey at one point turns to face a group of officers in the back of the room.
And mind you, the police, y'all are under a lot of pressure, and we understand that. But also, y'all have the power to take someone's life in a heartbeat.
He added, because North Carolina is an open carry state, he used to carry a pistol with him. Now, he doesn't, for fear of getting into a misunderstanding with a police officer. For Savon Rhines, the issue of compliance was a big one. He said a black man doesn't have the same chance to comply with police as a white man does. Rhines, who is a veteran, said that was the case in this latest officer-involved shooting.
We do not get the opportunity to comply in a lot of situations. When you consider that for every mass shooting that has occurred in this country, the majority of those being perpetrated by white men, when their lives are lost, is because they took them. By and large, they are taken into custody. Okay?
Yvonne McJetters, a veteran and AME Zion minister, urged Putney to have officers rethink their body language when they interact with civilians. When officers approach a person, she said, they often already have their hand on their gun. And that type of body language doesn't feel like a de-escalation tactic.
And I have two sons, and I don't want to see what happened to any of the young men. I didn't look at the video. The fact of the matter, I know he's dead. He's not coming back home. Whatever he did prior to or whatever, get your language right. Take your hand off your weapon and treat people like human beings.
Putney fielded questions and listened to statements for over an hour. The evening ended like it started, with a prayer.
And may he give you peace, now, henceforth, and forevermore. We shall all say together, amen. Have a good night.
And on the outside, the evening ended like it started, with reporters hoping to get a few more questions with Chief Putney.
Oh, y'all came back.
Putney confirmed there was no dash cam video, although he did say there was other video evidence that would not be released because it would hurt the investigation. By now, there was more noise Putney had to cut through. You could hear the spring crickets and people talking as they walked to their cars. During Tuesday night's event, many audience members shared their personal stories about their feelings towards the police. Putney says he understands he's not the only one in the city that's hurting.
I got to continue to listen to those stories because that is the human element that makes our policies take on life. The reason we revisit policies and training is because of those stories. We're talking about people, not just numbers.
Putney added he was glad there were police officers in Tuesday night's audience so they could hear those personal stories too. For WFAE News, I'm Sarah D'Elia in Charlotte.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, a combination of all three, before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terroristic.
Back in February, the authorities arrested a man by the name of Christopher Paul Hassan. And he was part of the Coast Guard who was stockpiling weaponry and planning an attack against members of the left wing. That included both politicians and members of the media. Now, he has been in custody, but it appears that prosecutors are refusing to charge him with terrorism charges. Now, again, he stockpiled weapons, was a self-proclaimed white nationalist, and was planning on carrying out acts of violence against left-wing members of the media and politicians. So Christopher Hassan has remained in custody since February 15th. That was his arrest and subsequent indictment in Maryland on federal firearms and drug charges. Hassan's attorney, Liz Oyer, wrote in a court filing on Monday that prosecutors recently disclosed that they don't expect to seek additional charges, which is strange because this was a motivated, it was a politically motivated attack that was luckily foiled by these investigators. In a February court filing, prosecutors called Hassan a domestic terrorist and said he intends to murder innocent civilians on a scale rarely seen in this country. They also said he is a self-described white nationalist who espoused extremist views for years and drafted an email in which he said he was dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on the earth. Mm. So, I'm glad that they're taking this approach of refusing to charge him as a terrorist because we need to be fair, and they would never do that if it was a Muslim defendant,
yes,
right?
The Muslim would never be sent to the gulag in Guantanamo if they were caught with 10,000 rounds of ammunition and a list of people he was planning to kill. It's just the latest example that the word terrorism has lost all of its original meaning. It's basically just become a word that is used by the state to basically punish Muslims without due process. I mean, that's literally the only thing that it is right now.
Well, if his name instead of Hassan was Hassan,
I know, that's
just a couple, one letter.
We would have had a terrorist case.
It would have been fun. It would have been, a huge media spectacle. The New York Post would have been all over it.
So close.
But yeah, I mean, and this isn't to say that we should expand the definition of terrorism to include non-due process punitive damage against all people.
Well, we've already done that.
Right. I think we should just retreat from that word entirely. Like this idea that that a certain crime would be different if it was terroristically motivated, I think is hugely problematic from a criminal justice standpoint.
Well, it's weird because the one thing that you just mentioned that we shouldn't do, we've already done.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the actual definition and actual applicable charges of terrorism, we don't use it toward those people. So this is a person who, again, said himself that he's this white nationalist. Yeah, he's stockpiling these weapons. And it's not like they're assuming that he was going to do these things with this weaponry. He had like a spreadsheet with specific people that he was going to target, how he was going to target them. And he was actually pretty forthcoming about certain things.
Yeah, all he needed to do was like nail it on his forehead. You know, just like I am a domestic terrorist.
You know, the thing is, which by the way, that's your wall now. Yeah. Is your forehead is the wall on your Facebook page?
Yeah, exactly.
No, but the thing is, as a Middle Eastern American, you get this a lot where people say, why don't Muslims condemn when there's an act of terrorism, et cetera, et cetera? They are condemning it. Number one. Number two, what these people are, terrorists that are Muslim, you know, they claim to be Muslim, or this guy who is going to be doing terroristic acts. They are criminals. They're criminals because there's a lot of people out there who are going to talk negatively about, you know, Jews and Muslims and Christians and whatever. They hate each other. But to carry out an act of violence, now we're talking about you're a criminal.
Yes.
Now we're talking you're causing – this is terrorism is to cause fear in people, right? Mm-hmm. So when I read about somebody like this, I'm a comedian of Middle Eastern American descent. I feel terrorized because I feel like this guy could find my show, a live show, and go, I'm going to go over there. There'll probably be a lot of brown people I can kill. So this is an act of terrorism, and I think that that you're right. I mean, the term should be applied as what are the results? The results are that it's terrorizing people with your actions. And so, again, I don't know the actual legalities of it, but just because he's white or just because Donald Trump decides to only condemn it when someone of Muslim descent is carrying this act out, that person is also criminal. So let's be equal.
Right. And you have to look at the current American climate when it comes to the issue of terrorism as a whole. So, for instance, since 2013, this was back when Obama was in office, and even earlier than that, during his presidency, the Department of, not the Department of Justice, the DHS, yes, Department of Homeland Security, had a section that specifically focused on homegrown extremists and terrorists, right? And that, of course, included non-Muslims who were radicalized or wanted to carry out domestic terror. And the right wing successfully got what they wanted, and they wanted that group to disband within DHS. Mm. And so what we've seen for years now is our government refusing to fully investigate the real threat that we face when it comes to domestic terror. At the same time, terrorism is used willy-nilly over and over again when it comes to people of color, specifically people of Muslim descent. And this is not about identity politics and we're debating who should be treated different. No, this is about keeping Americans safe. I don't care if you're Muslim, I don't care if you're Jewish, I don't care if you're Christian, I don't care if you're white, if you're purple, doesn't matter. We should have investigators in the Department of Homeland Security who do what it takes to keep Americans safe, period.
No, the real problem is Ilhan Omar's innocuous comments about 9/11. That's the real threat that we face.
It's amazing.
That's what they should be breathlessly talking about and freaking out about. Not a guy like this guy.
There was also something interesting at the end of the article where it said the Coast Guard spokesman has said that Hassan will remain on active duty until the case against him is resolved.
Oh, this is crazy.
I'm going, no, Colin, crazy. Colin Kaepernick took a knee and he wasn't on active duty.
Yeah.
And this guy.
It's crazy.
Really?
And by the way, I'm glad that you read that. I just want to read you some more details in what he was planning on doing. This is graphic 44. Hassan drew up what appeared to be a computer spreadsheet hit list that included House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, and presidential hopefuls Senators Kirsten Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and Kamala Harris. Several network TV journalists, MSNBC's Chris Hayes and Joe Scarborough, and CNN's Chris Cuomo and Van Jones also were mentioned.
What would Chris Cuomo ever do to get him so mad? I can't imagine. Like, Chris Cuomo? It seems so random.
Chris Cuomo can sometimes be spicy,
I think. You know, it's the list of presidential hopefuls. Maybe he was just overwhelmed by so many presidential candidates.
Oh, that Kirsten Gillibrand.
He's like, I gotta narrow it down. What do we got, 20 people in there?
She makes me so mad.
Now, this guy is... And the other thing that's interesting in there was it said that Hassan, I keep wanting to say Hassan.
It's fine. It's unclear how the pronunciation is.
If I say it enough, they may change their charges. It says Hassan pleaded not guilty last month to charges of illegal possession of firearm silencers, possession of firearms by a drug addict, and unlawful user. This whole thing of like guns aren't bad and people are bad and all this. I mean,
yeah, he had illegal possession of opioids. And he should not have access to guns if he is addicted to drugs.
Yeah.
And apparently he had a stockpile of weapons, including a silencer.
Context of white supremacy. This weekend, it is Easter. It is the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. Put anniversary in quotes. And this is a so-called cannabis holiday in some parts. All kinds of nonsense going down on this weekend. April 20, 2019, so I have been told. I do not recommend any of those so-called holidays, anniversaries. We have problems in the system of white supremacy. This is the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, comments on any of the news segments that just aired live. The new number, White's changed it about a week ago, 605-313-5164. Code is the same, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A few things before we get to the callers. Certainly, this is the religion of white supremacy on display again, with the so-called resurrection of white Jesus, and even the bunny rabbit. Dr. Welsing talked about that. Fertility symbols for whites, got to make sure that they get next generation of racist man and racist woman and their fertility struggles. And they got chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate associated with that so-called holiday. If you are in areas that are doing some sort of cannabis-related partying or what have you this weekend, I'll say it again at the conclusion of the broadcast, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I wasn't even aware of that nonsense. I was walking to yoga and I saw a mob of people outside and I was like, what is going on? This is Seattle, so I mean, it could be anything. And I see a mob of people and then I was like, oh, they're in line trying to get 420. All of the places where this is legal and probably even more, that nonsense. And security, that was, I think I noticed the line, and then I noticed they had enforcement officials, which they would have to because they had, you know, all these people and everything else. So that alone, no thank you. I will pass on all of that. Thank you kindly. I'm sure they'll have more enforcement officials and what have you out because, you know, got drugs, so that means we got tickets, and we don't want people out on the road, and we got to make sure we have sobriety checkpoints where the niggers are. Just like they said in the sound clip or the news report where they were talking about, we do the drug testing on the niggers who are in labor, because those are the folks that we want to take punitive actions, take their children and all the rest from these attempted mothers. Sobriety would be best. Say it again at the conclusion. Whew. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the listeners who have kept the cows broadcasting for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. You can also invest via the Amazon wish list. It is linked on the blog, or you can visit Amazon. It is linked under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list. Again, I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy, providing accurate information about what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be white, what victims of racism can do to solve this problem promptly. Other things to discuss before we get to the callers. We had a listener. She wrote in last weekend. She wrote in about the compensatory call-in from last week. We were talking about the passing of Nipsey Hussle, victim of racism. They had his homegoing services kind of in the middle of last week. We were talking about that last weekend, and I think I made the point specifically saying that I thought a lot of that, it reminded me of Dr. Curry's work, The Man Knot, and talking about how we only come to know black males through death. We got some of that this week. Black male shot dead in North Carolina. There was another, I didn't even play it. Black male wrote a book saying he was inspired to write through Trayvon Martin, only coming to get all this attention and focus and understanding of the black male as a corpse. Dr. Curry has written about that extensively. I said that last week in the broadcasting of the funeral and all of the emotion. I also said it reminded me of Mr. Fuller, where he said that we have, because of white supremacy, become kind of this worshiping, loving of death, necrophilia. I used that term specifically last week, where you have all of this emotion and showing out at the funerals and what have you, but we're in an environment where there's such flagrant disregard for black people that it's not really even believable. And I was articulating something to that effect last week. Some people felt that that was not the case. They felt that there was a lot of genuine outpouring for Nipsey Hussle and other victims of racism in general. So we were discussing that during the compensatory call-in last week. A listener wrote in. She said, I just finished listening to last night's compensatory call-in. I wanted to express that after viewing some of the footage from Mr. Nipsey Hussle's funeral services, that it reminded me of the auto-cannibalism that Mr. Woodard speaks of in The Delectable Negro. It, for me, was representative of how racists have conditioned non-white black people into self-consumptive behaviors. For racists, I think that them viewing that self-consumption is another means for which they are able to cannibalize the black body. Racists have made the black death experience a spectacle. They have defiled death in the same manner that they have defiled everything else. After all, as Dr. Tommy J. Curry noted in his work, The Man Knot, the black male is but fungible. Question, unrelated question, would you consider at some point establishing your own yoga teacher training certification program for black people? Now, I said, wow, when I got that, because when I completed my 200-hour teacher training, incredible to believe that's almost been a year ago, but when I completed that, beautiful black female that I was doing the 200-hour teacher training with, she's now teaching in Portland, she said, hey, you should do the rest of the training so that you can do teacher training for black people so you don't have to go through, so that more black people don't have to go through what we went through in teacher training. And I remember, and I think I even used a metaphor. I said, wow, I'm going to have to put that on the back burner. I think that's the exact phrasing that I used. I remember the conversation that we had. I cannot believe it's been almost a year, but I said, that's a great idea. I'm going to think about that. It has come up repeatedly in the time since, and that has been part of the motivation for why I have been doing continuing education and seriously trying to pursue 500-hour certification, because at that point you would be qualified, you could do teacher training. But I was thinking of that exactly to be able to train. And you could include like a counter-racist perspective to the teacher training. And it's already in. I was even thinking all of the 200-hour teacher training programs that I'm aware of, and even the 85-hour prenatal teacher training that I did, white supremacy came up anyway. Like, white people's whole history of involvement in yoga is practicing racism, stopping non-white people from practicing, limiting access, kicking Gus T. Renegade. Like, that's the whole history of their involvement in the practice of yoga. So, and I mean, we talked about it specifically. I wrote a paper about it in my 200-hour teacher training. They talked about it in the 200-hour teacher training at the yoga facility that I'm at. We talked about it. We watched a documentary about it in the prenatal teacher training. It would already be there. It would just, you get to include, you know, a different perspective as you go through to do it. But absolutely, that would be something for sometime in the future, hopefully. But yes. Glad to hear others were thinking in line. I think that's some, I would encourage people to pay attention. I think Mr. Fuller recommends sometimes the universe will send you signals. I think that can be one of the ways that you get signals sometimes when ideas are presented more than once, especially if it's a really bizarre idea, like something that you would not have even considered, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 weeks ago. And now you get that idea, and then the wackiness of life, you get that idea again. You should definitely write that one down. Save it. File it away. Might be a week. It might be some months. It might be 5 years. But that might be a message from the creator. Or not. Let's see. Other things. I already mentioned, but I think worth mentioning again, the segment where they talked about the stress that black mothers face, which I think that is certainly believable in a system of white supremacy. And I've heard that before. Dorothy Roberts talked about that specifically, and she's in the video that I used on social media and promoting today's broadcast. Dorothy Roberts, she's been on the program repeatedly. The book Killing the Black Body, she talks about the racism, white supremacy explicitly in the whole crack babies and everything. But she talks about the exact same terrorist campaign. That's terrorism, too. When you go to attack a pregnant black mother while she is giving birth or any point in the labor process, and oh, wait a minute, you tested positive. Oh, this is, I got to go make a phone call. That right there is terrorism, putting you under all that stress, stealing your child from you. Same thing that they're doing and complaining about border snatching and all that with no outrage, and then come shake their finger. You did this to yourself. I don't want to hear any complaining. Not going to have you drug addict, you know, mothers and your crack addict babies ruining, you know, our life and ruining this child's life. You get your act together, and then maybe, when I used to work at social services, it is so easy to steal children from black parents. It is super easy. Super. I cannot emphasize that enough. Firsthand experience. It is way easy. And you generally are talking about the people who are least qualified to defend themselves in terms of language, words. And for you heard in the audio segment, the black mother who it took her so long to even find out where her child would be located. That's what you would be talking about. The people who would have the least access, probably might not even have access to internet, you know, might have to struggle to get online to even, you know, figure out, do some searching to find out where her child is taken to, might not have a vehicle, might have to rely on public transportation. Like, and whites in places like Atlanta, not Seattle where they don't have Negroes, but places like Atlanta, where you have a lot of black people, whites have already planned out, we'll have a whole lot of Negroes here that we've mistreated. So we'll make sure that it'll be difficult for them to get a new self-driving electric vehicle. And we'll make sure that the public transportation is horrendous. So it might take you 5 hours to get from your residence to wherever we've, you know, relocated your stolen child. That word, attempted parent, I think that's in the word guide. Great illustration of why Mr. Fuller uses that term. Accurate. Can't sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, because I suspect that they would do the same thing in states even where cannabis is legal on 420 day. That would still be grounds to take your child. I could be incorrect, but I do not see why that being legal would all of a sudden halt those type of campaigns. Maybe I am in error. But sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Another great reason. And those tests, we talked about that as well. The likelihood for false positives, that even the tests, there seems to be an element of white supremacy racism that could be deliberate, where it seemed that for whatever reason, black people had a tendency for false positives, meaning you have black people who had not consumed any cannabis, but for whatever reason, miraculously, they would have a higher probability to test positive anyway. False positives, they call those. Next. I would say the segment where they were talking about the difficulties, racism, that black female elected officials experience. It was difficult for me to listen to that segment, not because I don't think these individuals, black female elected officials, are experiencing white supremacy. They are. However, the way that it was presented, it wasn't even accurate. At one point, Andrea Benjamin, I believe this is a victim of racism. This is an audio segment, but I think this is a victim of racism. She's a professor. She said that she was talking about it, a black female being labeled as aggressive, angry, you know, if they are speaking with confidence and speaking out for themselves or taking a what they call controversial position. Absolutely, that's racism, white supremacy. But she said, if I was a man, I would be entrepreneurial. That is inaccurate. You have to be specific in a system of white supremacy. If you were a white man, if you were a black male, you would not be industrious and what? No, you would be an uppity nigger too, unless I'm in there. And that's one I would stand pretty confidently on. Like, you would have to show me the evidence of where black males are not aggressive, including Gus T. Renegade. I can give you my own anecdotes where it was intimidating, all of that, for just pointing out, wait a minute, I was not an inaccurate Negro. I actually did give submit accurate information, and I wasn't yelling and jumping up and down and cursing or anything like that, and I was still labeled as intimidating. And I think I could give quite a few other examples, personal illustration, and talking to many others. There seems to be a wide pattern globally in the system of racism, white supremacy. That's why, I mean, it's not even accurate. There was another point where she said that she would have students say, oh, wow, you're my first female professor. Now, again, that cannot be accurate. And that's a major error, in my view, in the system of white supremacy. Again, anytime we talk about affirmative action, the greatest beneficiaries are white women. It's no way possible there could be a white student anywhere in this country saying, oh, wow, this is the first time that I've had a female professor. You lie. You lie. No, you have had tons of white women professors K K through 12, and then once you get to the college, absolutely. I had tons of white female professors. Now, if she meant you're the first black female professor, well, then that's not what she said. Be accurate. Words are important, and those type of errors, they come up all the time in those type of segments where they're not saying white supremacy, racism. It's just focused on patriarchy, intersectionality, because they mentioned that there, and it ends up being inaccurate. It would be VGQ if it was just, hey, you're just saying whatever you're saying, and that's fine. And you can take victims guaranteed qualified to say inaccurate things. However, as a victim, I also take VGQ inaccuracies, including when Gus T. Renegade makes errors. Those have to be pointed out. Strive for accuracy. We are in a system where the number one weapon is deception. That segment right there, just giving out totally false information. I thought President Obama was talked about as though he was up. They used some of the same tactics. I thought they said that he wasn't a U.S. citizen. They used some of the same tactics for him. System of racism, white supremacy. We are not dealing with patriarchy, sexism. That is not the problem at all. And the inaccuracies were both ways because it left out the role that white women play as well. As I said, there's no way you could be in a university system anywhere and say that you do not have white female professors. That is totally bogus, a lie, and that supports the system of racism, white supremacy, because it minimizes the extraordinary power of white women. Again, the greatest beneficiaries of affirmative action, sorry, Ms. Fisher, white women. That's another great lie that they always minimize it. Oh, it's the Negroes. Anyway, the metaphor that was used, this is our compensatory call-in, when they were talking about the black male who was shot and killed in North Carolina, the man not, guess he was not entrepreneurial. They said that we are here to find common ground. I have no idea what that means. Those type of metaphors, especially when it's serious, we're talking about a fatality, we're talking about racism, period. There should not be vague metaphors where people will clap. Yes, common ground. Amen. Mm-hmm. I don't know what, at least one person should just be honest, and you don't have to be nasty. I don't know what that means. I would rather that we be, you know, explicit, clear, direct, and not have vague metaphors that seem like they are communicating something when they are not. I hope that we are here to find truth, especially since we have a fatality. I hope that we are here for truth and justice. Can I get an amen? And the whole church. That's what we would hope. That's what we would hope. But even if they don't, no metaphors. Man, people get way the deception. Oh my goodness. Racists, they are so skillful at using metaphors, similes, analogies to cause all types of confusion. They are the best at it in the universe. We victims have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, Gusty included, we are still learning. As such, there are times we will substitute a lot. We don't have the logic that we need to articulate what we want to say. We will substitute and use a metaphor of some sort. Frequently, this just contributes to more confusion. Sometimes you might just need to take additional time to think about what you want to say, get your thoughts together. That is fine. But at least on this broadcast, if we could not use metaphors, I will prompt about that. Very important to be mindful about what we say. If we could take about 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts, observations that you have, that would be great. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps to minimize distractions so that people don't have to compete with a lot of music in the background or other people talking and that sort of thing. I did want to make sure I got in one comment. Tiger Woods, cowbell. I think I said last week that I also thought that that was another aspect of consumption of black bodies, having and I mean literally, it was mobs of whites out chasing this Negro male, Cablination, that's what he said, right? Chasing him and this white golf ball, Dr. Welsing, grandcestor. But that, too, I thought was consumption. To see all of these whites, and so many whites for the past week, cheering, and oh, what a story of redemption. The tackiness, it does not get any better than tacky. I thought, wow, we spent a decade, I thought, just talking about Tiger Woods is scum. Mr. Fuller talked about that. They would just get on television today. He's scum. They would have people come on and you betrayed us. We had our children. I remember this. I watched this for years. I remember we had Dr. John Hoberman on the program, Darwin's Athletes. We had him on and we talked about Tiger Woods just before all of the bad things began happening in 2009, Cal's decade. And I said that he's a nigger. That's what I thought then. And I think Dr. Hoberman, we had him on again, like some years later, and we discussed Tiger Woods and it was, oh, wow, the change, blah, blah, blah. But he said he thought the moment where things changed, they had him on the cover of Vogue magazine, no less, and he didn't have a shirt on. And he said it was the convict black male look. Like he had never seen him. This is a golfer, you know, not running around with no shirt on and such. But he said he felt like that was Tiger Woods has been niggerized at that moment. And then, you know, things proceeded from there. But I just felt it was the height of hypocrisy, deception, tackiness, really, to pretend as though all of that had not happened. I still feel in the way that you heard some of it in the report and talking about, he didn't even say thank you. Just the way that he yelled, the way that he was and all of that, just the way that they talk about him with such spite. And then to pretend like, oh, we're so proud. We're so happy to see him do it again. Go Tiger. I'm going to get me a red shirt so I can do it on Sunday. Just delectable Negro. And the hypocrisy, I cannot say it enough. The hypocrisy. They talked about lynching him like on national context of white supremacy. That is one of my favorite Samuel L. Jackson movie segments of all time. That was from the movie Changing Lanes with the great Ben Affleck. But that was him, Samuel L. Jackson, talking about the Tiger Woods commercial where his dad was so motivated because he didn't want a fat white man to tell his son to get cigarettes and beer. But that scene, I said, oh, yeah, I've got to use that this weekend. One of my favorite Samuel L. Jackson movie moments of all time, Changing Lanes. Reading is more important than watching television. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello, Matt. Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Irie in Louisiana.
Greetings, Gus, and everybody on the line. I have so many thoughts on what I heard, but what's most pressing right now, I really do need some guidance on a situation that occurred last week. So I received an email actually a week before last, toward the end of the week, saying that my son was displaying signs of depression from his English teacher. And she was concerned, and she said she referred him to the counselor, and that he was adamant about saying he was okay, but she wasn't sure about it. And so she was reaching out to me. So I called her instead of emailing back, because I try to make a practice of listening to the words that are coming out of their mouth, the way they're saying it, so I can kind of gauge what the situation could be and could not be, you know. I mean, and that's still subject to, you know, unknown factors. So anyhow, I call her, I say, yeah, I got your email. And so tell me, what are you seeing? She says that he used to raise his hand a lot and share a lot, but it stopped after Christmas break. And that was a concern to her. And she said, she also said to him, and I quote, "You know, I miss that beautiful smile of yours. Where did that beautiful smile go?" And so the first question in my head was, what is this woman talking about? Like, why is she sounded enamored. And I don't know if that's a metaphor. I just know she sounded smitten in a way. And so, and by the way, my son is a teenager. He's like middle teen. So I was like, okay, maybe she's one of those hippie people, you know, or something. Let me just listen. So she continues. And then she says, and you know, another thing, he used to come to school with his shirts, with the shirts, with the sleeves cut out, because, you know, he has that beautiful physique from football and wrestling. And then I was like, okay, no, this is not appropriate. You are literally like consuming my son sexually, you know, with your eyes. And so I didn't say anything at the time because I'm one of the people, I'm not one of those kind of people. I'm either going to be completely still or it's a bad situation. And I did not want to react the improper way, uncodified, and make the situation worse. So I just listened to her. I said, okay. I said, well, is there anything he's doing in school or in your class academically that is showing you he has signs of depression, or has he said to you he's depressed? So she said, yeah, he was feeling a little under pressure. So that's what made her refer him to the social worker. So moving on, I talked to some friends, well, not some, one friend about it. And she was like, you shouldn't say anything about it. Just let it go, because it could possibly make it worse where she'll come out and then accuse him of something if you try to, you know, if you talk to her or if you try to address it with administration at the school. But I'm not comfortable with that at all, because, again, you're here, you know, you're sexualizing a child. You're not concerned about his mental health. You're concerned about why you can't see my son's body parts. And then I have further corroboration of her basically doing this, because I asked him specifically, what has she said to you? He said, she's always asking me, how you doing today, X, Y, Z. And, you know, I see you don't have your, you know, your sports shirt on. And then she mentioned to him that she had, quote, an ex-boyfriend with the same name. That's not something that should be said in school. Part of me wants to go to her directly and talk to her about it. And part of me wants to go to her, or we'll talk, have a meeting or something with the dean. I'm not sure how to go about it, because all I know is my concern is, yes, I don't want any other white female teachers, because that's what she is, to develop some type of pact where they do something harmful to my son academically or, you know, socially, in the school, if he needs recommendations, et cetera. He's on the honor society, so he doesn't need anything to throw him off his, you know, he's on a positive path. And if there's anybody out, I mean, I teach and I'm stumped on how, what's the best way to go about it to make sure my son stays protected and stays in a favorable light, because I just don't need some woman lying saying he whistled. You know, it's just ridiculous. I don't appreciate what I heard, and I will mute my line. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry if I was a little, you know, spazzing out a little bit, but thank you.
No, no cause for apology. That is, you know, definitely serious. And I think it's, I always think it's a correct strategy to analyze if you don't respond immediately, to kind of assess. And that way you can formulate the best way to proceed that will be advantageous for you. So it is, well, before I say anything, and certainly if we have any parents, it would be awesome to hear your thoughts. black parents, you should not be a spectator this evening. I do not have children. My counter-racist perspective, it's April, and it's almost May, in fact, so I don't know when the school year ends out there, but I mean, it's almost May. I would think the school year has got to be coming to a close. If your child is not a senior, if he's about to at least be ending the academic year, it would seem that he might not have her the next academic year, or at least that would be a potential to no longer have her. So it would seem like there should be an easy remedy. Pending on what you want, that's also something that I would devise. I guess you can listen to some of the suggestions, but I would sit down and try to clearly, if you haven't already, to think about what you want, what you think would be the ideal resolution for this situation. Already have that in mind when you, you know, go to execute your plan to go talk to her directly or whoever you want to speak to. But it would seem like it shouldn't be too difficult to get him out of her classroom for a month. Like, I've seen situations like that before where you can have a study hall or something like that. I mean, the year is almost over. I mean, I don't know, you know, what they're doing, what the schedule is, if it's June or whatever, but the year's almost over. We got like a month and change left. Basically, for some people, it's less than that. That seems like something that could be an easy remedy for a situation with those type of remarks. I would take that very seriously. There are so many, Mary Kay Letourneau, I think people are familiar with. That's a white woman who is out here in Seattle, who raped a non-white child repeatedly. She was arrested, went to, did time in prison for this repeatedly. I would take that seriously, making those type of remarks about your son's arms and not having more of his skin available because he doesn't have his shirts on and all of that. I would take all of that very seriously, comparing him to a previous boyfriend. All of that to me sounds extraordinarily inappropriate and hypersexual, which can be a pattern with those white women professors. I think I said something about that before. So, yeah, I would take all that very seriously. And it does not sound like an environment that would be conducive, especially if that, in addition to these allegations that he's depressed and going, but same thing with the black parents. I don't know if that's supposed to be an allegation against you. Maybe you're doing something wrong or, you know, whatever. Maybe he needs some of her loving to get him correct. But yeah, I think all of that sounds, you are right to be cautious and super concerned. And I would be trying to extradite my son from that situation for the last month or whatever it is. Yeah, I guess other folks as we proceed can respond. Unless, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you said that, because when she said that she referred him to the social worker because of all the, you know, because he's cladding himself, it's like, okay, you're saying my son has a mental deficit because you can't look at him anymore. I did take it that way. So the school has made it difficult to be able to just drop in. That's another thing why I'm frustrated, because I've tried to go over there without an appointment, because she was like, feel free to come in anytime. So I said, okay, I'm going to take her at her word. And I went over there and they're like, no, you have to have an appointment before we let you in the school. And I understand security, but then at the same time, it's like, you know, it's like they're making it hard for parents to check, the parents that do check, because I'm one of them. They're making it hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like she may have said that because she knows it's going to be hard for me to get in there and just come in without her having advance notice. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Standard operating procedure. And that's one, I know this isn't workplace racism, that's Fridays, but I would check the policy and procedure about their policy for parents visiting the school to see if that is the case. Do you have to get an appointment? Because that seems irregular to me. I've worked in school systems before, and I'm not familiar with it having to be a scheduled appointment. You have my child. What are you talking about? Scheduled appointment. I mean, yeah, that's one. I would check policy and procedure. And we are all still learning. So for folks with children, That is a great question to ask at the beginning of, if you have any of your children in public. This is why Dr. Welsing would say, hey, let's have these conversations before we get to the bedroom. That way, the first 10, 15 years of our child's academic program is planned out. We don't have to deal with white racist educators lusting after our children, males and females. Other folks who dialed in, especially black parents, if you have suggestions for Irie and or other comments, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Strap-the-mania.
Greetings, Gus, and callers and guests. Irie, I'm sorry that your son is having to go through that, and it just seems like it's a pattern. Anytime these races cannot get their way with us, they have a tendency of diagnosing us with mental illnesses. It just reminds me of Draftomania, you know, because, you know, the slaves wanted to be free. Now they're diagnosed with a disease called Draftomania. So just because this teacher can't lust after your son, now he's being diagnosed with the mental illness of depression because he's not coming in to class scantily clad. So I think we're going about it in the pop.
Oh, are you still there, Draftomania? Did we lose you? We may have lost Draftomania. Hopefully she will ring us back.
You know, just keep your eye on it and, you know, make sure hopefully she won't cause more problems for your son, because it seems as if she's causing problems for your son because she can't have her way with your son. So that's what I wanted to say on that. But what I wanted to also talk about is I wanted to give you an update concerning my situation with this stalker. So last week, I think it was on, it had to be on a Sunday, because we had, I had been on, you know, the phones with you guys that Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So Sunday, when I came home from work, I was in the kitchen and I was cooking, and my the window is right there near the street where this man has been meeting me, you know, at late night. So as I'm cooking, I look out the window and I see him, this man, ride past the house, and he's looking right directly at me because the stove is exactly in front of the window. And he's like, you know, like I said, they're very bold. You know, these suspects, they're bold because they know that if they do something to us, nine times, you know, the majority of times they will not, there's no repercussions for them killing us or anything that they do to us. So I took note of, and it really kind of startled me, and it shocked me. It gave me some anxiety. So I went back to cooking, and then I looked again, and he bypassed again. So that's when, you know, what we discussed on the phone and during the calls, it kicked in. And I then took you guys' suggestion, and I called the cops. I called the authorities. And I explained to them, you know, this white man, he's been, you know, coming by the house late night, parking in the parking lot. I explained to them everything that this man was doing. And what they told me is that, you know, I needed to get like more pictures, like try to get some type of pictures or something like that. Get his license plates and, you know, try to get that type of information. But at least I did have an opportunity to at least report it to the police, because if something else should happen, at least it's on record that I did call. And the police, what happened, because I thought I was going to have to go down to the police station. But when I called the cops came to the house. and I was able to talk to them here at the house. So that was a good thing. And I'm grateful that I was able to discuss this on the cows, because this is a form of support for me, because I really don't have that much support. And I'm glad that I have been able to get some good suggestions and all the suggestions that I've been able to get, because, you know, sometimes when you feel like when you're on your own and you don't have support, you know, you kind of feel like you'll minimize things when it's happening to you. I mean, for me, that's been my pattern. Like, I'll minimize things that are serious and things that I should take serious, because I feel like, you know, it's just going to be minimized, or it's not going to be taken seriously, or I'm not going to have the support, or, you know, things like that. So I thank you, this program, for just giving me the courage to, like, you know, stand up and do what I need to do regarding my own safety. And I also wanted to report, there was a young man, he was 22 years old, and it's upset me, because, you know, we talk about trauma all the time, and, you know, what do you call it, racial trauma. You know, and when we continuously see things happening to us via the media, on the news, through the newspaper, we're just, you know, constantly being re-traumatized over and over and over again. And there was this young man, his name was Tyreek Jamal. He was 22 years old. He graduated from North Carolina A&T. And he had a white supremacist suspect neighbor. And the neighbor had been harassing him, had threatened his life. And it kind of reminded me of some of the issues that I've been going through. And he went down to the courts and tried to get a restraining order on this white man. And the judge denied the order, because she said that he didn't have enough evidence. And what ended up happening is this white man ended up murdering him. He shot and killed this young boy. He was about to become an engineer, and, you know, he was about to have a bright future. And, you know, he went through all the proper channels to try to prevent this situation from happening. And even though he went through all the proper channels, he still ended up getting murdered by this white male. You can look up the information on the internet. That his killer is named James Allen Verombeck. He's 53 years old, and the murder happened in Glen Burnie in Maryland. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Much obliged, Draptomania. Be safe. I'm glad you were proactive in that situation. I agree. Do as much as you can if it's additional lighting. They even have, the technology has advanced so much that they have really cameras and such that you can have on your residence, on your property, that, you know, really are not a lot of money. So there are lots of things that you can do if you want to look at more safety options. But I think if you are retired firefighter talked about exposing, you can get some pictures, more information, license, all of that. That's what I was saying, maybe even getting the cameras. I think that'll put you in a much better position. But just be as vigilant as you can. Take that super, super serious, and maybe even tell some of your neighbors, if you have some non-white people or what have you, that you have a rapport with who live in the area. Let them know as well, so that they can be on the lookout, and then you can give them the pictures and such, you know, if you can get any sort of photos or anything. Other folks who dialed in, again, parents, no spectating. If you dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I wanted to respond to, I believe, the female caller's name was Irie, in regards to her son being sexually harassed by a white female teacher. I think my suggestion would probably be to gather all the information that you have given to us, formulated in some sort of letter, where if he's in a public school, send it to the principal, also to the superintendent in regards to this incident. If it's a Catholic school, send it to the whatever archdiocese you're in, or if it's a private school or a charter school, send it to the owners of the charters as well, so you can have these incidents documented. So if there's nothing done after they know that this white female teacher has been sexually harassing your son, then at that point, my next suggestion would to be is to get an education lawyer to further this, because unfortunately, like I said, your son is being sexually harassed, and this is a serious matter that you should take very seriously. So that would probably be my suggestions in regards to that. That's all I have for now. I'll leave my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Great suggestions. Documentation, helpful once again. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. To the first female caller, I think that you were, I think that she was pretty accurate and on her means to rectify the situation involving her offspring. I've had similar situations with my now 23-year-old when he was the same age. This is not uncommon when it comes to black females. One reason why that black females are willing to go and teach in areas where the majority of the students are non-white black is for that very reason. I don't even know where what is the population racially where your child goes to school at, but one reason why white females go to areas where there's a lot of black children is because of that very reason. And I know that you are accurate on your analysis based on what she was saying. I would say, although I agree with you, I understand that it is a concern about repercussions that may come to your child, but you know, in our fragile global state, we don't have that much control anyway. But at the present time, it appears to me that your child is already in some sort of jeopardy as far as that concern. If you got a teacher that is expressing to you, boldly expressing to you and giving you reasons on why that she thinks that there's some sort of problem with him, and the only thing that she can describe is something that can be connected to some kind of sexual connection or experience. And that's the only thing she has as far as the report is concerned. So what I'm suggesting, and this is what I did, I asked immediately for a meeting with that teacher and the principal. And in my case, she came with some notes based on what she observed, and I had some notes myself, and I stated to her that basically what it is a personality conflict. But you are paid to teach my child in that particular subject. That's the difference between the two. One is a student and the other is a teacher, a paid professional, supposed to be. And basically what they did, they removed her from, they removed him from that class. And my offspring went on to graduate. But that's what I would do. The whole idea with an attorney, that's a lot of money. that's a lot of money as far as that concerned. I don't even think it has to go that far, you know, as far as in my opinion. But to have a conference with the principal and that teacher. And if it has to go any further, the next thing would be if the person that's in charge of the school district area, of that immediate area where your child's school is and where that person operates a certain amount of schools, and that'd be the next step. But it probably wouldn't have to go much further than the principal and that teacher. With the second female caller, once again, doing the right thing, be aggressive on it. Every time you think you see that person or that vehicle, call the police. Most times they don't even, they offer to not even to come to your door. I'm talking about the police. They'll go right to that person. They'll go right to that person, and they would ask whether it's against, quote unquote, against the law or not. They would go right to that person and ask them, well, why are they there? That sort of thing. They were asking for a driver's license and identification, that sort of thing. And see if that person wants to put up with that all the time, that they want to come in that area. Like I said, a person that has some sort of incorrectness in mind, they don't like exposure. They don't like to be exposed. And one thing they would know that someone is paying attention to them. And they don't like that. They are experts in finding weaknesses and fear in people. And with that knowledge of fear, they want to take advantage. They try to take advantage of that person in that light to continue on with their terror. And by you keep calling them and calling them, they eventually go somewhere else as far as that concerned. And I just tabled everything else that I had to say, because, you know, when I'm hearing some callers that's in some sort of distress, you know, and I have some sort of experience that I think I can help with. That's what I attempt to do. So thank you for listening. Hopefully I made some sense. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943. Pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, callers, listeners. On the first caller, Ivy, I wanted to touch base as a single parent as well. This is it's very distressing, and it probably causes you a lot of issues. Try your best to also do some things to make sure you take care of yourself, because it can be very frustrating. The caller from Chicago really hit it on the head, pardon the analogy or metaphor, but it really was straight to the point on that. Definitely lawyer, I think, is necessary. Have that in the background first, but also get a child advocate. You could find that by going online in your local area, just Googling most, you know, closest child advocate or whatever in your area. And you will find different groups, mainly non-for-profit, that will be able to help you out in this scenario, because you want somebody else as a third party there when you're having these meetings. Retired firefighter was very on point when he said that definitely having the meeting is important, but you really don't want to go into these meetings by yourself, because they won't come in there just with one person. They'll come in there with 3 to 4 people, the teacher, the principal, and somebody else outside of their district that would actually be trying to sort of mitigate or even push your buttons, or again, metaphor, apologize, or even try to agitate you or get you upset to do or say something incorrect. I've had this happen on multiple occasions with my son. And these whites are so bold that they do not believe that you will be codified enough to practice any black self-respect. So when you come with the advocate, they automatically will feel threatened and be on the defense. And again, this is something necessary to document. And then when you have to go further and bring it to the lawyer and bring it to that level, you then have somebody else also that can verify the situation that you've gone through. It's very important to have that aspect of it, because the schools will protect themselves for sure. They will keep protecting their teachers, white supremacists or not, regardless in regards to the situation. So please bear that in mind. So I would suggest definitely getting a child advocate right from the back. One of the segments, the Vogue albino, I definitely looked into that while that segment was going on, one of the first ones, and looked it up. And as Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing pointed out, recessive genes. Everything I Googled looking up albinism, everything just kept on coming up, recessive genes, recessive genes, recessive genes. The only other thing that came up outside of that was a question, which was, are albinos considered black? And I thought that was kind of interesting. Also, this is somewhat a little different from a little bit of the things that were spoken about, but I've been just looking into being more codified in recognizing my enemy and Googling racist white supremacist symbols, clothing, facial features, everything. And I think it's very important that we start becoming more codified when we walk around and we see these people, because we'll get an idea of how extreme they are to some degree based on their appearance. Because I've seen simple things from I've seen people that have Madison Grant, obviously one of the founders of eugenics, has that weird stringy mustache. And then if you Google him and you look at other people, you'll see that there's a ton load of other white supremacists that carry that same weird stringy type of mustache, even Lawson Starter. And I'm based in up north in the north and eastern section of the country, I see people like that on the train. And I pay attention to it now because I realize, like, that's just not some fad. You don't just pick that style of wear because it looks cool, you know. So, again, that's just something I wanted to throw out in the process. And I wanted to ask in regards to, I don't know what anybody has any comments on this, but I wanted to hear a little bit of comments of what anybody felt about ADOS. I felt like Nellie Fuller Jr. really hit it on the head that it sounds that ultimately that even if there were any kind of reparations put out, that whites would find a way around it to include themselves, push the situation to make it non-effective for non-white people. All right. That's all I have to say. And thank you for your time and energy. Peace.
The reparations thing, I guess that is getting more commentary, but we've talked about that like a lot this year. Like, I think at least because someone emailed me about it. Like, we talked about that. The exact point that you just made, like, over in Thomas in New York has talked about it repeatedly. Like, I know it's got to be other people here. My memory cannot be the only one functioning somewhat correctly. Like, have folks not heard us talk about that quite a bit over the last month, I would say?
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Correct. Correct.
That's what I thought. Memory is not that bad. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Black African, good to hear from you, sir.
Yes, sir. to the lady with the her son in that situation. She used the metaphor. She said that she was stumped, sorry, which is like, I guess, a tree that's been cut down, and like the stump of a tree. And I think she was trying to say that she was confused. And if we were to use codification, I concluded that she should ask questions, not just of herself and, I mean, and to us on the show, but I think she, whether she gets a lawyer or not, that she should approach it in a questions and answer mode, like, basically, like, these are the terms and conditions that this teacher used to suspect or to accuse my son of being depressed, which is a very serious accusation, or because it's like a mental disorder, I believe. Then she would basically state those terms that were used and see if there's a resolution, try to say, is this something that is appropriate? Is this appropriate language? Is this appropriate? Or is this, I don't know, what's the term that I'm trying to get to? Is this professional? Is this legal? Are these terms that are used for such accusations? The clips that you played, I thought it was interesting that it sounded like Tiger Woods was being, like, as if his parents were bad parents and now he's a good parent. There was sort of like a comparison made. I think the person said that Tiger's parents were different, but he wants to be different with his son, Charlie. So I think there was an accusation there that Tiger Woods' parents were not good parents. There was a metaphor used about is it Congresswoman Omar? One of the ladies said that she was on the chopping block, like she was on Trump's chopping block. I thought that was an interesting metaphor. There's an associate of mine that I started to use like a lot of metaphors. Like I started to like point out metaphors. And so we started a game where we would go back and forth on metaphors. I think it's an interesting game. Like you can just write a metaphor and you and that person go back and forth. Maybe use like, for example, like the word chopping was in this metaphor. So if they had used this metaphor, I would maybe use like, for example, cutting edge technology, because of that. And then you go back and forth to some kind of theme on a metaphor. It can be interesting. It can be funny. That's what I noticed. I thought it was also interesting that the domestic terrorist person, I thought that it was interesting that it sounded like they said that he was a drug addict. So he's a drug addict and he's a highly suspected terrorist, but he was still employed. So I thought that was fascinating. I also agree about what your analysis concerning Nipsey Hussle. I would see images of this black male. I knew that he was a rapper, but I didn't know details about what he did or details about him until he died. So I mean that's just from my experience. And then finally, I heard the term on that Young Turks skit clip, Middle Eastern American. I've never heard that before, so that was fascinating. It's like encompassing a whole region, and it's a made up region. It was just so fascinating to hear. Thank you, and thank you for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing. Black African, word games with metaphors. Love it. That right there. I mean, that will have you, will help you be more attentive to how words are being used. That's certainly something that we're supposed to be encouraging with this specific program, the compensatory call-in, and with counter-racism in general, just being a lot more mindful about how we use words and how others use words, because that is such a core component of how white supremacy racism is practiced. So keep that up. That is awesome. Let's see. Other folks who... Oh, and just to make sure I share, it can be, often is, extremely stressful, whether it's the situation, if you're a parent, you've got to go and deal with racists in the classroom, or if you have a workplace situation, a lot of times it can be very stressful. I was telling folks the situation that I've been dealing with regards to the yoga studio, that has been super stressful and has been going on for a month now, a little over a month, in fact. I did have a non-white female, super supportive, several of them actually, but super supportive and encouraging self-care. She even had the audacity to talk about how this can be so stressful and to make sure that you're resting well and eating well. Like, that is super important. That is one way that you can support other victims of racism. If you know that they're having an acute situation of racism, to check in and make sure that they're sleeping well and give whatever support that can make a difference substantially for victims of racism, and to just be mindful of that. Those type of situations can take a toll, to really make sure that you replenish and take care of yourself if you're dealing with some major incident of mistreatment and you're having to do some major counter-racism work on a daily basis. Other folks who we've not heard from at all, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. I wanted to make mention about a number of weeks ago, no, maybe a number of months ago, I said that can't know Arab, Chinese, or white person have America or any of our other land. I meant to say no Arab, Chinese, or white person can have our land. Didn't mean to use two negatives. The other thing I wanted to say was with the albinos, the black albinos, they are black. The black albinos is not our enemy. The ice albino is our enemy. They are the albino of whatever the white people, they are the albino of whatever creature they are. Because living things, all life has albinism. That white people, they're our problem, that particular group of albinos from the ice. Those are our problem. And it's very cold right now. It was cold earlier today, but it wasn't the day before, 2 days before that. It was 80 degrees. White people are terraforming the earth. They're making it very cold. People need to speak about it more often, record it, broadcast it. It's one of them. I mean, it's a very, very evident, very visible thing. And very obvious is the word I was looking for. It's very obvious. You know, we can just make a big deal out of this, or we can speak more about this. We're speaking about a whole lot of things, but we can also speak about white people blocking out the sun that gives everybody life. And if we're able to get the sun, make the sun stop being blocked, white people will have a difficult time here. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. I did want to also make sure I got in the segment on Tiger Woods. There was a reference, Color Monitor's reference in that report. They talked about Tiger Woods being a machine. It's basically that he was programmed to do this one thing, to just go out and play golf. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist, has noted that that is a pattern where black people are not humans, machines, things, robots. Invisible Man, in fact, makes that same point. But Tiger Woods, he's not even a human, some sort of, you know, robot that just goes out and plays golf and rapes white women. Others that we've not heard from at all. Feverish. Others that we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida, proceed.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with the segment from the, I think that was a black female that was speaking about, I know that metaphor about the chopping block. I caught on to that one too, I noticed that one too. And she was also mentioning the term women of color. And I'm thinking of the term, I think it's called oxymoron or whatever, because once again, they're not mentioning the white women who are beneficiaries, as you mentioned, and they have a tremendous advantage. And that, yeah, that is a, that's an inaccurate comparison to make if I were a man. But you got to have specifications on that, because the majority, I think, are still white men or white people for the most part. But she also made a comment about how they are expected, I guess, as black people to only talk about welfare and government assistance, something that's expected, that you don't really have to, I guess, utilize your brain very much. But when you want to start talking about diplomacy and foreign policy, and she used the metaphor, if you're not in that box, like you're not at that limit, you have to be, I think that means immaturity, where I know Mr. Fuller mentions having to become men and women, universal man, universal woman. That's an attempt at putting forth time and energy and effort to solve real problems and not to be at that limit, just to speak more directly. And there was a funeral today, the black male who got shot at the Waffle House. It was quite a bit of people that came to the funeral, and I know funerals were mentioned. And the Young Turks, I think that was the Young Turks segment, where I think that was Anna that was speaking, and she used the term amazing when she was referring to the tactics that the admitted white supremacist was trying to utilize. And he, I don't know if that was his manifesto or whatever, where he had a plan to kill almost everyone in the world or something. That might not be accurate, but she used the term amazing and crazy. And, you know, it's just anything to not describe racism, white supremacy for what it accurately is. And my last one was, I don't know if anyone saw this commercial, but it's a tremendous Wilson moment where you have, it's, I think it was KFC. You have a white man in a white suit, apparently dancing with a syrup bottle, Mrs. Buttersworth. And that's just, I don't know if anyone has seen that commercial, but I think that would be categorized as the Wilson moment. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
The waffles and chicken. Yes, I did see that commercial. Colonel saying he's plantational looking white man at that.
I've seen it.
With the Miss Buttersworth syrup. That's pretty flagrant illustration. And waffles and chicken at that. I mean, they might as put a Cheeto sandwich up there too. Excellent reference. Welsing moment. Caller in Florida. Let's see. Did we miss anyone? Anyone have commentary that we have missed totally? Grant, I'll give out the number one more time. We have roughly 30 minutes in case you have additional comments, questions. If we miss somebody, if you think you have a question, certainly if we have any parents, as I said, you can't be a spectator today. If you are a parent and you think you have a suggestion about what would be the best way to handle the situation from our black mom, the white educator, and her black male child, you should definitely give us your thoughts. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The segment on albinism, and that they have this black female who suffers from albinism on the cover of Vogue. I thought it was interesting because to me it sounded like she was saying that they wanted to talk about her or present her within the context of quote unquote discrimination in South Africa and albinos being mistreated in South Africa, which I thought was interesting because that to me it sounded like, I could be in error, but to me it sounded like it would be black people are discriminating, quote unquote, against albinos. This is terrible. Look at how she's been mistreated. That's the way it sounded to me, because I know I do hear that narrative frequently from the continent. Albinos are mistreated and, oh, it's savagery. And, you know, they use their body parts. They believe in witchcraft and all the rest of this. I hear that narrative on a regular basis, which I think is even, it's worse than tacky in a system of white supremacy where you don't report that. You report that black people are racist against albinos. Maybe I'm incorrect or I just wasn't listening close enough. Other folks, if you have additional comments and we didn't get to hear everything you had to share, proceed. Certainly if we have folks who have not shared at all, do not lollygag. Go ahead and get a hand up.
Yeah,
greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. To Ari, I think that, Gus, what he said and what everyone has said, you know, it's great. And that was my first reaction, that at all costs, you should remove him immediately from her and even ask him if she has touched him. And whatever consequences that may follow, I mean, if his whole... if the whole trajectory of his life has changed as a result of removing him from her or anything like that, like even negatively, it's worth it because he is going to be more harmed if he stays around the child rapist, and he will be more harmed if he is raped versus if his academic life has changed or something like that. And also because, you know, shout out to Dr. Kambon, because white people are very serious about raping black children. And I also wanted to thank you, Ari, for the advice that you gave me of how I can best not shake white people's hands, because I don't like to do that. And I do different things to avoid it. When you mentioned just clasping my hands together and bowing, that really helped. I did that recently. I wanted to say about last week on the compensatory call-in, there was discussion about when a black person is accused of killing another black person and that being attributed to anti-blackness and to our confusion and, you know, just this notion that, you know, we kill each other. I stated that none of that is accurate. However, I did not mean to come off as accusatory, and I'm sorry for that. If I came off that way, and I think that I did, and I will do better next time to articulate myself and what I mean. And also, I was not referencing anything that you, Gus, that you said, because you didn't even give a prescription for, you know, why these things were happening. You didn't give any, you know, generalizations that, you know, we kill each other, or, you know, that this is the reason that, you know, this black person is accused of killing this other black person. You stated that violence is encouraged, but you didn't give a prescription as to why. So everything that I said was not directed at anything that you said, because you mentioned that you didn't mean to come off a certain way, possibly that you were generalizing or anything like that. You didn't come off that way at all, and my comments weren't directed at anything you said. It was also mentioned that Nipsey Hussle that he didn't sell records the way Tupac did, and the suggestion was that people were not as interested in his music. That's not true, because no one is selling records anymore, and hasn't been for over a decade. And if Tupac was here today, I don't think he would be selling either. And that just because people didn't buy a lot of Nipsey Hussle's music, that doesn't mean that they weren't interested in it. What it most likely means is that they're doing what they've been doing for over a decade now, which is stealing the music instead of buying it. I also wanted to say that changing to, like, eliminating dairy from my diet has brought my iron up tremendously, and I've been iron deficient my entire life, and even iron supplements have never worked. Recently, they worked temporarily, and then my iron just went right back down. But as soon as I eliminated the dairy, my iron went back up and stayed up. And I just wanted to say, I had a question actually for you, Gus, which is that, are you still scheduled, for lack of words, to go home in May? And I just hope that everyone else, that you all enjoy the rest of your weekend. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged. So far, haven't heard anything to the contrary. Looking like, hopefully, May we'll be able to head back and flood victim status. I'll just be a victim of white supremacy and no longer a flood victim. But, you know, we will wait until all that has happened. In the meantime, that is phenomenal about your iron deficiency problem being corrected by eliminating dairy. I have heard that from other folks as well. I am no fan of the dairy. Try to encourage other folks to, you know, minimize, get that out of the diet. All that cheese and milk is just not healthy, not good for us at all. And I've heard from a lot of other folks that they also had a lot of great health benefits and just a lot of constructive results when they took that dairy out, were more mindful about what they eat. In fact, the cows Labor Day yoga retreat, as I said, we were trying to do California for July 4. We didn't have enough people. They said, let's see, check for Labor Day, August 29 to September 1. That would be Thursday through Sunday, August 29 to September 1 for the California Labor Day yoga retreat, plant-based meals. I spoke with Chef Nadira. She did all the cooking for us out in Virginia. She said she'd be down to come out to California and do plant-based meals for the whole 4 days, three nights, yoga all 4 days, do it up in the summer correctly, and then get ready for December at the end of the year. But just eating plant-based meals, being mindful about what you eat, being mindful about what you say, being mindful about what you eat can have a huge impact. How you think, how you feel, it's monumental. Cannot be overstated. We have other folks that we missed completely, or folks, if you had an additional comment, question you wanted to share.
Gus, can I add this real quick?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say, I forgot to say this, that one of your guests, I think her name was Tracy McWhorter, She said directly that if you are facing iron deficiency, to eliminate dairy immediately. And I think, but I'm not for sure, if Dr. Lathan said the same thing. But I wanted to mention that that was stated on your program directly from vegans. And just wanted to give you and just your program just credit for that as well. I mute my line.
Much obliged. Dr. Lathan, she said she'd be down to come back like a quarterly basis to give updates so people can have questions. If you heard her the first time around, like, oh, man, I had a question that I wanted to ask, write it down. I guess you could email. You could put Dr. Lathan in the subject, and we could save them up when she comes back. If you try some of her recipes or you try some of the suggestion, you try eliminating dairy from your diet, you can share. Hey, I heard you the first time around. I tried it. This is what happened. Let her know. I'm sure she would appreciate the feedback. But cleaning up that diet as best we can, or just being mindful about what we eat, trying as best we can to eat healthful, huge, huge impact. Then get some exercise in with that. Maybe a little yoga. Spectacular.
Hello, Jess. Can I be heard?
Let's see. I heard both of you. Let's get Irie first.
Did you speak? I don't think she spoke yet, right? I'll wait.
Oh, yeah, I did. This Draftomania. I spoke.
Oh, okay.
You can go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to thank everybody for what they said. I'm going to ask for a meeting with the dean, and I'm also going to put it in writing because it's a very serious, that's a very serious event that occurred, and I feel like that has to be in writing somewhere. I'm also going to send it certified, so that way it's considered a legal document as well. So thank you, everybody, for that. And somebody mentioned albinos being mistreated by Africans. I've seen videos where they're pointing out Africans, like little children, being scared because they're seeing an albino child that's African for the first time. And yeah, that's a racial showcase and confusion tactic, you know, in my opinion. And also, one other thing, I saw a documentary, I think it may have been on Vice, and it was a year and a half ago. There were a couple non-white women, they were not Black, but they were non-white women who were pregnant, and they also were in, they were in a group with some white women that were pregnant that had little clubs that they engaged in cannabis smoking or edibles to what they say aid in the delivery of their children. So for that young lady to have that event happen to her, where first it's negative, then it's positive, it's amazing. And as someone said years ago, I heard them say the law is discretionary, so it all depends on what a person practicing racism wants to pursue at that moment in time. And that doctor definitely did not have to pursue that, especially if there was something in the records showing that the child at birth was negative for THC in the baby system. Thank you.
Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Draftomania?
Oh, I just wanted to ask, guys, have you had a guest on your show by the name of Robin DeAngelo? She speaks about white fragility.
I've talked about her several times because about once a month someone will write and ask me about having her as a guest on the program. So I try to announce about every 6 months. I invited her to be a guest on the program, I think, in 2014. This was about when I started to notice, like, oh, wow, we're pretty popular at this point, like, what, or well-known, I'll say. Whites know about us much more than they did before. So I wrote her, and she says, oh, let me see which program you're talking about. So I sent her the information, and then she wrote back. She said, oh, I'm too busy. My schedule's full. And I said, and the way that I processed the same thing that I told to her, that's just an act of racism. if you were busy, that's what you would have said from the beginning, not, oh, let me see, you know, the program. And then, oh, yeah, I don't want to mess around with these folks, because she talks or she practices racism, white supremacy, everything about her concepts. The only thing would be the same thing that I would say to Anna Brown Griswold, Timothy Wise, any of these other whites. Heather Heyer, if they want to talk about resurrecting whites, if they could bring her back. Are you a racist? That's all we need to know. Not how you died in Charlottesville, not how you inspired the 2019 champion University of Virginia men's basketball team, not how many books Tim Wise has written. Are you an admitted racist? You put Jane Elliott in there as well. That's it. And in fact, we've had Cows listeners who said that they thought Robin DiAngelo was spectacular, great, awesome white woman. And I said, well, when you listened to her, did she admit to being a racist? And the person said, yes. And then they stopped and thought about it. I will give them at least credit for that. They stopped and thought about it and wrote back and said, you know, she didn't say that she's an admitted racist. I don't know why I thought that, but no, she doesn't say that. I mean, what? Come on, man. Let's be truthful. We're not just going to come out and sell lots of books and confuse non-white people. Whites are not fragile. It is white power. Just that concept alone promotes incorrect thinking. We're talking about a power dynamic where whites have the dominant power position and use that power to terrorize non-white people. You can get lots of these whites to get thousands of dollars to go about and talk about white fragility and white privilege and all other sorts of white nonsense, but they do not talk accurately about white power, white supremacy, white terrorism. Even James Long, we can't get the word terrorism in sundown towns either. Other folks.
And yeah, because I was listening to her today, and when you have the guests on your show, the suspects, and you ask them how they practice white supremacy, and in this in her talk, she was actually admitting to when she was practicing white supremacy. So I just thought it was just kind of interesting. And she has been on another gentleman that I'm not sure if you've ever heard of him. His name is Philip
Matthews. She's on lots of programs.
Mm-hmm.
She's out. She's very, very popular. I'm very aware. She's been out for years. She's very popular. And more importantly, as I said, that concept, it's not fragility. It's white power. So, yeah, I'm very familiar. She's practicing racism, white supremacy like the rest.
Right. Thank you.
Other folks have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I wanted to say with the temperature, it went from, so my mom had, I sat down with my mom and she was telling me, so she charted the temperature and it had gone from either 78 or 80 degrees, one of those temperatures, down to 54 degrees within maybe a two-hour period, maybe a three-hour period. This is all before 3 o'clock p.m. That's how quickly the temperature changed from white people spraying chemtrails in the air, making domes to reflect the light, refract the light, however you say it. And also, it went from 80 degrees to snow flurries, maybe last night it was reported there was going to be snow flurries. So this is affecting black businesses. I mean, it's affecting our life. It's killing us, but also it affects black business because black people get up later when it's cold. We get up later. We go out less, it's raining. We don't support the black businesses. And I go to black businesses and, you know, eat at the restaurants, and they tell me that they've been having a difficult time because it's raining right now. But it's been raining for, you know, how many months, sir? The other thing I was going to say, was the retreat. So the retreat's coming up, and I want to endorse the retreat. Just saying that I went to the first retreat in Virginia and I enjoyed myself. I was satisfied with my experience. I spent my money, my time, my energy, my thought, and it was a good investment of time and thought and energy, and I would suggest people to do that. It's good to de-stress. So, thank you.
Non-paid endorsement for the Cows 10-year anniversary yoga retreat, but much obliged, Imhan Deesi. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy coming all the way out from Kentucky to hang out in Virginia in all the mud and rain. Was there someone else who spoke up at the same time?
Yes, sir. This is the Black African. I also want to sponsor the retreat, the yoga and vegan retreat. It was awesome. It was just a great event. And I guess something that I thought was, that was interesting with the mud and everything. You get to meet people like, you know, we got to meet, like, for example, Imhan Deesi, and, you know, he was in the mud and he was getting sprayed with mud from cars. I mean, you know, it was just it was an interesting event. It was a great event. Let me just say that. I quickly just wanted to say about the albinos, because I'm from that part of the world. Well, I was born in that part of the world, and I've spent some time in that part of the world. And I would say there's certain regions where I've noticed that people produce more albinos. And I think it's because the Black people have been put in, you know, like Bantustans, or they're confined in spaces. So I think albinism is, if you have that gene, if both parents have that gene, then they produce albinos. And what I've noticed when I was there is that people don't harm albinos. Albinos are just people. They're just other people. And most people, a lot of times, especially in the Bantu sense, are afraid to even make fun of or to say any kind of negative thing against albinos, because albinos are likely royalty, because I guess like royal people like to keep things in the same family or whatever. So, you know, you make fun of somebody for being an albino, or you say something, not even for being an albino, but then they end up being somebody important. So I don't remember anything to the scale of what's being advertised, and I haven't even seen people being made fun of. I just didn't experience it. And then really quickly, the Black moms, when I was in so-called like Southern Africa, especially in my teen years, there was a lot of advertisements about the HIV and AIDS. And I remember being very confused about what I was seeing, because they would make huge billboards everywhere. And in the high school that I went to, a Black female was put in front of us, and we were told that this Black female had, I guess, HIV. And I remember being so confused, because she just looked so beautiful. She was, you know, like, she looked so healthy, so beautiful. And I couldn't stop. Like, I kept asking people, like, what's going on with this? And the more I asked, the more I realized people were just confused about it. And I remember people would just say crazy, well, not crazy, but uninformed things about this HIV AIDS. I remember hearing, like, family members saying, like, in this neighborhood, there's five people with AIDS, you know, five people with HIV. Like, people were confused about it, and I was also confused. But it wasn't until I started listening to the Cows that I understood what was going on, and I understood my confusion. And then from that day on, I told myself that any kind of language where, you know, like, Black females, Black moms, there's any kind of, like, health and some kind of negative connotation, or, like, you know, Black males are giving them some kind of health and negativity to it, I just don't believe. So until I get, like, more proof, I just don't believe what I'm hearing about black moms and their babies and their, I just don't believe it. Thank you for letting me share.
Much obliged, the black African logic, because that's such a tacky, you know, and long running white supremacist strategy. Notoriously syphilis soaked race. That's why I mention medical apartheid all the time. And in that book, she references Dorothy Roberts, Killing the Black Body. I mentioned her already this evening because they have been doing this for such a long time. That's why. That's a logical stance to take, that I'm just going to assume you're practicing racism, lying about black mothers until I see some evidence. And I mean, it's going to have to be like a lot of evidence. Any other folks have comments? We are almost done. Compensatory call-in for this evening.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Speaking of yoga retreat, just wanted to ask you, did you see my last report on Facebook?
Uh-oh. I fell behind on a message. I have to see the update. Retired firefighter checking out locations for Florida December 27 to January 1 on his homework assignment. Thank you kindly.
If a possible host that would render his house and he has an acre of territory that belongs to him. The biggest problem would be the number of people. And ironically, he is also a yoga instructor. But I know the essential thing is when I brought it to his attention, the number of people I figured by if you would contact him, and I left his contact on your Facebook, that maybe something could be worked out with that particular issue. That was the only issue that he was concerned about when I brought it to him, was the number of people. He said something like, well, somebody would have to be sleeping in sleeping bags. But then again, I figure, you know more of the details than I do. And if you two guys would have a conversation, that it probably something could be worked out. Maybe. I don't know for sure.
Thank you kindly for doing the research, retired firefighter. I will look forward to getting his contact information and going over the details. This is for Florida. They will work it out end of the year, December 27 to January 1. Those are the dates. So we can start 2020 in the correct counter-racist mindset, looking to solve problems and start the year correctly, as they say. But December 27 to January 1 in Florida, I'll check my email, my Facebook messages, and let people know as we get more details and get things planned for the end of the year. With that is a full broadcast. Thank you kindly for everyone who participated. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy, whether you listen live or to the archives. Archives available at SoundCloud, YouTube, Black Talk Radio Network, Google Play, and a variety of other platforms. Still having difficulties with iTunes. Think it might be we have to get a new iTunes altogether, iTunes feed altogether, so that folks can access the current content. And that's, I think this is at least the third, fourth time that we've had to do that. And it's a lot of material to have to move. So, counter-racist grind, always work to do, to be expected in the system of white supremacy, but those other outlets are available and current, so you can access the material from those outlets, and the older content is also available online as well. If you have difficulties finding archives, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you need information as well on the retreats, you can drop an email about that also. With that, I will say it again. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. War is being waged against us. We would do well to be able to use our brain computers to maximum efficiency. Dr. Welsing would certainly co-sign on that one, I think. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.